of the science aspect of what he was discussing.
Chris is an amazing intellect, and it's always a learning experience for me,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. You know, I was just absolutely very well impressed. And his thoughts as I wrote to you in an email were extremely well-spoken and very well-founded. And, you know.
Well, that's why I prefer the conversations with with the members of the Horn family, 99.9% of the time, to any so-called expert, because there's real expertise here in everyday folks just getting through life. Jim, I've got a roll. We're at the top of it, but it's awful good to hear from you, and a pleasure to be back home for the conversation.
Listen, a happy Mother's Day to Agnes and your family. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you very kindly. I'll tell her you said so.
Okay, you take care.
Bye now. It's our good buddy, Jim. And it is time to get out. Thanks for the kind contributions that rolled in this evening. We actually managed to cover what any given night of broadcasting needs to cover. And that's amazing. And thank you for those of you who still remembered and contributed even during my absence. It doesn't happen without you. Thank you, and it has a more special meaning now, having actually met him. Thank you to our chat room moderator Lottie, who was such a genial host and excellent guide during my time in the Northeast. Thank you to our other chat room moderator Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas Gene and Susan, our blogger Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox, and thanks to always thanks to Ben Birch. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And go and learn about the ache, Appalachian Community Health Emergency, at StopTheAche.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, we begin tonight's program this Thursday, the 10th of May, 2012, with me simply happy to be home and in one piece. Okay, why is something... Hold on. Okay, well, that was a weird noise, but... In the last 24 hours, I have become accustomed to weird noises. Let's work backwards, shall we? Instead of starting with what happened at the beginning, we will work backwards. I'll just tell you what's at the forefront of my mind right now. Like I said, oh, by the way, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network. This is the Horn, America's liberal voice, available for your listening pleasure in a variety of formats and platforms. You can, of course, always listen easily at both headonradionetwork.com and whiterosesociety.org. And you can listen at Stitcher Radio, both live and in repeat. You can listen at TuneIn Radio. You can listen at Tuner Internet Radio. You can listen at iTunes Radio. You can also get the podcast at iTunes in our podcasting. The podcast feed is also posted at WhiteRoseSociety.org. So far, so good? Okay. I'm thrilled to be back. It's always a choice between the devil and the deep blue sea, whether to be here or to be out doing the activism work that I think is critical to, well, my family, and by definition my family's, and by definition my continued survival. And that's what this trip was about. Of course, I went from here to Charlotte, North Carolina, where I got on a plane bound for Boston, which I saw for the first time in my life and was thrilled by. We Southern people do need to get north of the Mason-Dixie line once in a while. It's good for us. Then, of course, I went from Boston back to Charlotte, where I've been since Monday, and arrived home gratefully last night. Let's get to that grateful. Shall we? By the way, this is contributor-supported radio. You members of the Horn family, you know that, and I thank you for your ongoing contributions and the support that makes it possible for this to all have been happening since roughly February 2004. Kind of hard to believe, isn't it? The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So. Yeah, it was rainy when I arrived in Charlotte, and it remained rainy. And then, Tuesday night, it was, the heavens opened up, and we weren't very far from the airport itself, which is a very, very busy place, I might add, since it is the central East Coast hub for U.S. Scareways. Which I flew from Charleston to Charlotte and Charlotte to Boston and Boston back to Charlotte. But there was a lot of lightning, and I thought, oh great, this is going to make flying home fun, with immediate visions of a terrified William Shatner, who had much more of his own hair back then, in an episode of The Twilight Zone, looking out the window as little gremlins tore at the skin of the wings of the aircraft he was on. Yeah, it turns out he got the better end of the bargain. I mean, they didn't take me off on a stretcher screaming in a straitjacket or anything. But, there are planes that run directly from Charlotte to Charleston, West Virginia. I was not fortunate enough to be on one. I instead flew from Charlotte last night to Washington, D.C.'s Dulles International Airport, at which point I boarded a plane from Dulles to Yeager Airport in Charleston. Well, it worked out this way. I got to the Charlotte Airport in plenty of time and sat outside in the... I know, you hate it that I do, and I'm working on stopping, but it just is a fact of my reality right now. Got there in plenty of time and sat out in the smoking gulag, thinking that, you know, I would just sort of take care of the nicotine Jones up front until I could, get some, well, until Charleston. There's that famous old album, No Rest Till Hammersmith or whatever. Well, there was no smoke till Charleston. At least not that I was interested in. We'll get to that. So I finally boarded the plane for D.C., and it was one of those little Canadair regional jets, which, while not particularly comfortable, are at least reasonably reliable. And again, it was raining. And there's something about a rainy airport that just calls up all your worst nightmare memories of airport disaster movies, whether it's Airport 1 or Airport 77 or Airport 6 and 7/8 or my personal favorite, Airplane. And we got, I got on the, I boarded the plane, got all strapped in. There was, bless its little heart, a howling little darn near newborn right in front of me, who then settled down right quick. I think it's the pressure. I think it's the pressure change in the cabin that messes with a newborn's mind, and it is uncomfortable. It's one of those things that we grow accustomed to as adults, but it's not fun. And then, you know, they do the pre-boarding thing, and they tell you how to make the seatbelt work. I think I've got that down. And so we're ready for takeoff, and then, of course, the captain comes on with his obligatory... That's what was making that noise. Okay, the captain comes on with his obligatory pre-flight address. And it sounded a little bit like this. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for flying United Airlines. Well, they're heading to Washington, D.C. today. I'm not kidding. It really, really did. And I'm thinking, oh, great. Leslie Nielsen's the pilot. That was a bad day to quit huffing glue. But I thought, well, maybe that's just the way the bad... Yeah, it's the bad audio. And that everything will be okay. And it seemed to be. Except for the fact that as we taxied down the runway and we turned out the... I popped the clutch and we went howling and screaming down the runway to achieve liftoff velocity. We got off the ground, and, you know, you get off the ground, and immediately the landing gear comes up, and it turns out I was sitting right over top of the landing gear. And you hear the mechanical sound of the landing gear being retracted, but that was followed by a boom noise. And those are not typical in the airline industry. And, okay, all right. So we climbed and climbed and climbed until we finally got up above the ceiling of what was a pretty nasty front. And just about the time we stopped climbing, we started descending into Dulles. Had a lovely conversation with a gentleman seated next to me. Flying is always ever so much more fun when you've got somebody to talk to instead of everyone sitting in sort of stony silence, rather tomb-like. Had a very, like, it was a great conversation. Very smart man. Turned out he brewed his own beer. And we had a nice talk. And then as we're coming down for landing, then we hear, gree, and you know, that's the landing gear coming in. Gree, clank. And he looks at me, and I look at him, and he says, you know, they don't usually make noises like that. And I said, I was just thinking the very same thing. So we touch down, and I don't care if you're in a 67 Volkswagen or a Canadair regional jet, the sound of a tire blowing out is pretty much the same. Kawam! Pocketa, 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 pocketa. And that's the sound it made. So, yeah, I looked at him and I said, you know, I think the tire just blew, and that's when it went. And he said, and I think that was the last of it just now flying away. Lucky for us, there's two sets on each side. That's fine. So I figure I've had my adventure for the day. But then, Dulles is not a terribly convenient airport. I think I walked about, 40 miles between terminals, and at a pretty fair clip because my plane for Charleston left at 10:12, and got there and looked outside to see something referred to as a Saab Fairchild, Saab-Fairchild. 340. So with my handy-dandy smartphone, I looked up the Saab Fairchild 340 and found out that this aircraft, operated by some low-paid subsidiary of United Airlines, had not been, it was last manufactured in that particular shape and format in 1985. Great. Now, if you look way, way back in the archives, you'll find that this is the same aircraft that I flew back from Dulles to Charleston on a previous trip to Massachusetts that was like a bombing run over Hanoi, because we had this huge, nasty front blowing up from, it was running straight up the Appalachians and off to the starboard side. It looked like God's disco with all the lights flashing and the lightning and stuff. And our pilot back then stayed out of it as long as he could, but apparently we had some member of the John McCain fan club or something who just wanted to plow straight through. And did. Good God Almighty. I thought the flight back a few years ago was bad. This was infinitely worse. This was one of those where you actually begin to contemplate the fact that you're going to be on the news. Or at least the pile of rubble smoking away in a crater somewhere in Appalachia that used to be you is going to be on the news. I mean, we were falling and climbing. Those twin turboprop engines were laboring madly. It was beginning. If I'd been old enough, I would have had some flashback of the bombing raids over South Pacific Islands, just having been shot up by Japanese AK-AK or something. We fell so far so fast at one point that had I not had my seatbelt on, I would have gone flying around the cabin all by myself. Yeah, free fall, zero grav. Because my arm, which was not strapped down, suddenly went, whoop, involuntarily up over my head. And my leg kicked out into the aisle. Sure, Lottie, smooth level flying is boring. So, meanwhile, the young flight attendant, seemed like a nice fella, was going back and forth. You want some Coca-Cola? I said, no, I prefer not to wear anything else on the way in. And he said, good. And he would just periodically come back with his little garbage bag to make sure nobody was having seizures or anything. And I looked at him and said, does this run like this all the time? Because every time I've taken this particular flight, it's been like this. Oh, no, not like this at all. Sometimes it's worse. But we did make it in. Landing at Yeager Airport in Charleston can be an exciting experience because there is it is literally a sheared-off mountaintop. It's one of those places where, you know, sometimes it is necessary to alter the shape of the terrain in Appalachia. That's one of them. There's a far cry, though, between creating a regional airport and lopping the tops off of 500 mountains in a region of the country to get at 6-inch seams of coal that are going to do nothing but make people rich, you know, one percenters, and doing something for the public good like building an airport. But it can be a little dicey landing there because there's a lot of wind shear. And we came in with engines laboring and banking over from one wing to the other, feeling the fuselage of the entire plane yawing from one side to the other. Yawing, yeah. Next I was expecting goiters. But we managed to land. And I got out. I looked at the young flight attendant, and I said, "You performed quite admirably under intolerable situations." And he said, "Well, thank you." I said, "But dude up in the cockpit needs a little more time on Microsoft Flight Simulator, because these little regional airlines, they really are. At one point in time, Delta was paying its regional air pilots less than a manager at Taco Bell. I don't know if that's still the case. Well, come visit, Lottie. You would have loved that flight. Just make sure your connection goes from Boston to Dulles, and then make sure it's United, and you'll get that flight. Because it's like that a lot. Because that little Saab can't climb above anything nasty. It just plowed through. I mean, there was lightning out the windows. It was a real party. And I got off the aircraft, and I was furious. I was simply furious. Instead, maybe it's time for Bob to have an attitude adjustment, because I was not just... Well, I manifested my gratitude. Granted, I didn't have the white robes or the Prada bag or the Jimmy Choo, red Jimmy Choo shoes like the Pope does, but I did. I got down on the tarmac and I kissed the ground. And then I got home. And that was another hour driving up the road, up the mountain. In, you know, no rain. There was nothing going on. There were no great big red blotchy things on the weather map. I don't know if Doogie Howser, amateur flight simulator pilot, was just having fun. Was that you in the cockpit, Lottie? Was that you? And went to unpack, and the suitcase that I had checked, as opposed to the ones that I carried on, the suitcase that I had packed and checked, as I unpacked, everything in it was soaking wet. The suit, the shirts, the clean, the needing laundered, it was all wringing wet. So suffice to say, United Airlines and I are going to have a little chat. I began it today. I'm sure that it will continue. But I am oh so happy. Oh, so happy to be back here and be behind the microphone. I had a magnificent week away. I met some amazing people. It's really thrilling when you get to meet people from outside Appalachia who are engaged in the same struggle you are, and you realize that the struggle is of a national, if not international, and in fact, global nature. We had two speaking engagements in the Boston area, one at a church out in Sudbury, which was a beautiful, beautiful place, and then in Cambridge, where, granted, 31 years too late, I finally made it to Harvard. We got there on a beautiful day. It was their May Fair, street fair going on in Cambridge Square. And we spoke at the First Parish Unitarian Universalist Church there. Lottie came to visit at that event, and the day previous in Sudbury, our good friend Les had come to visit, and I got to meet both of them, and it was a real thrill for me on both instances. We know each other via the little family that we have built here on the Horn. But then when you get the actual opportunity to shake somebody's hand and give them a hug, it just makes the connection, that the bond, that much tighter. It was something really, really special. And it was a special, and the folks that I got to work with from the Greenpeace anti-coal campaign, a young woman by the name of Monique, who was sort of one of our guides and guardians there in Boston, as well as a young man by the name of Pete, who knew Boston, they both knew Boston like the back of their hand, and shepherded us from one place to the next wonderfully. And just of such goodwill and such good conscience that when you meet people like that, you realize that there is hope. And of course, the group I had never met. There were some members of the group that I had never met before. I'll use first names only, and I hope they don't mind. From Wyoming, a brilliant young woman by the name of Kristen. From Washington State, a dedicated activist by name Matt. who is a water keeper out there. And from Montana, are you there? Are you listening, Kate? You've got a new ally out there. From Montana, my roommate during the Boston portion of the program, we shared a hotel room, a young gentleman by the name of Lowell, all of whom were passionately committed to seeing an end to the sickness, the agony, the suffering, the misery, and the grim death that the coal industry and its profit-driven motivations wreak upon our communities. At some point, I'm going to reach out to Kristen and Lowell and Matt, and I'm going to invite them on this program because I want them to tell you, I'll tell you a little bit now, but I want them to tell you what the banksters and the profiteers of the coal industry and the railroad industry, Burlington Northern Santa Fe is a one of the bad actors in this, have planned for one of the most magnificent parts of the country that we yet have, namely the great American, the mythic great American West that lives in all of our imaginations and may reside only there if the profiteers, the banksters, and the railroaders get their way. Because they have a nightmare planned that will stretch 1,000 miles from the coal fields of eastern Wyoming across Montana, over Idaho, and into Washington, that will render the whole area another toxic sacrifice zone for nothing more than the filthy profit of a tiny handful of people who neither live there nor care about those who do. I've spent a lot of time over a lot of years talking about Appalachia's agony and what the coal industry has done to us here. And that is ramping up. It's already going full tilt in the Powder River Basin coal fields of eastern Wyoming. But it is ramping up for a giant railroad run to the Washington state coast. And it will unleash, it will open the lid of a Pandora's box of ecological and, more importantly, human health horrors, the likes of which they have not even begun to nightmare. And we all spoke about all of these things, and it culminated on Wednesday with a massive protest and a humongous rally in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the annual shareholder meeting of Bank of America. I can hear booing. Bad actors. Bad bank. Bad. Yeah, it was really United, Marty, when it was United that assimilated Continental, not Continental assimilating United. It's all United now. It was terrible. I had the opportunity, and I tweeted it. It's out there on my Facebook page as well if you want to see it. Well, not exactly. Yeah, you can see the debrief. But I got inside, thanks to the efforts of the folks at the Rainforest Action Network, who put in a tremendous amount of work organizing. It was part of a larger movement called the 99 power.org is their website. RAN is, of course, Rainforest Action Network. It's either RAN.org or I think they both redirect rainforestactionnetwork.org. RAN in particular were very receptive and of my attempt to bring the news of the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Campaign to a broader audience, and I did at every opportunity. But I had a proxy statement, and I got into the shareholder meeting. And, you know, we've had conversations from time to time on this program about, and it usually goes something like this, are we moving toward fascism? And I have long taken the position that it's not so much are we moving toward, but now that fascism is here, what does it look like? And I got a very clear picture painted for me on Wednesday in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, there we were. You know, I was wearing suit and tie, okay? You know, I didn't have my my macrame sandals on and my short pants and my ripped T-shirt and you know, no, I was not by any stretch of the imagination casual. I was dressed for business. And as shocking as it may seem, I actually know how to dress that way. And all of us were, who were going to the shareholder meeting. But you would have thought from the police presence on the ground all over Charlotte, North Carolina, that they were under attack. They weren't. There was not an unpeaceful protester there. And for those of us going in to the shareholder meeting, there was no intent but to go there and ask a question. To address the corporate governance of an outlaw bank. So we walked to the place, stood in line for a couple of hours, watched pre-planted Bank of America employees be shepherded into the meeting first so as to try to fill up the room, but apparently not enough employees showed up to do that so as to keep us out. There will be hell to pay, I imagine, already this morning. Where were you? I had to go to work. No, we told you to come to the shareholder meeting. You're fired. But this is what fascism looks like in America when nothing more than nonviolent attempts to get the attention of an outlaw bank are met with private security forces, an all-hands-on-deck call to the local constabulary, and complete corporate paranoia everywhere you turn. All for people who had no intention of doing any violence or any ruckus whatsoever. Peaceful marches, a little bit of chanting, and some very well-dressed people going into a meeting, respectful of the process. Well, we got in and sat down, and that shareholder meeting had a Charlotte cop about every 10 feet, armed to the teeth and ready to kill. And then we began noticing that some of the people in slacks and sport coats who were making their way into the row had the handles of firearms sticking out of their coats or bulges under their arms that are telltale and unmistakable. They were willing to gun us down in cold blood simply for questioning corporate malfeasance. And not questioning corporate malfeasance as some sort of outsiders, but as their shareholders, the comptroller, a representative of the comptroller of the city of New York was there to address issues of corporate malfeasance as a shareholder, because the city of New York owns a whole great big honking boatload of Bank of America stock. And Bank of America had loaded the room with plainclothes, private security thugs, and cops who were ready to gun him down in cold blood. I will say, incidentally, that it was rather interesting that the city of Charlotte enacted a draconian ordinance that forbade women from carrying magic markers in their purses, and a whole list of other stupid things as a means of preserving the peace and keeping security. However, if you wanted to bring your handgun, there was nothing anyone could have done. I decided to leave mine here. But the private security thugs didn't, and the Charlotte police certainly didn't. It was a little nervous-making to see such a brazen show of corporate thuggery. And thus, my answer to the question, are we moving toward fascism? And Marty seems to agree. I'll argue we are not moving toward fascism. We are past it and moving towards something a lot worse. And the a lot worse part is simply fascism with the mask pulled off. And that's what we saw. This was a shareholder meeting. I mean, this is typically, a shareholder meeting is typically somewhere that, you know, people talk with their teeth clenched. And, well, you know, my position in this share has changed by 12% this year, although I was not at all pleased with the dividend that was announced in the last quarter, Muffy. I don't know what we shall do in the next quarter if we don't see at least a nickel fall, 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 fall. But instead, the shareholder meeting was an armed camp that was armed not for our protection, but against us. And so there was a slate of resolutions to be voted on which Bank of America took comments. The CEO, president, and maximum dictator for as long as they'll have him, Brian Moynihan, formerly of Marietta, Ohio, just across the Ohio River from Williamstown, West Virginia, presided. There were questions, there were resolutions that would have, there were resolutions that would have, for instance, gotten Bank of America's funding out of political campaigns. There were resolutions that would have moved Bank of America toward a more self-critical and self-examinatory approach to the way it has handled its foreclosure process in its mortgage department. There was a free there was a corporate free speech resolution. And the funny thing is, after all the discussion was had on that, they announced that the balloting was now open, and about 15 seconds later announced that the balloting was closed and that the results were in, and all of the corporate provisions had been all those resolutions had been rejected, you know, the ones that the directors recommended against, and that all the ones that the directors wanted had been passed. Because the vast majority of shares are owned by the directors and the officers of the corporation, no matter how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of shares are owned by organizations like the Comptroller of the City of New York. Still, many of the resolutions got 27 and 35. I think upwards of 40 was the highest amount of support that any of them got. But the balloting is now closed. Please read the results. I've never seen such a profound manifestation of the don't give a damn quality of oligarchic governance structure inside a corporation. And then, of course, back in Boston, before we ever got to Charlotte, back in Boston, I was blessed with a little epiphany from the goddess of irony. We had visited the Bank of America headquarters in Boston, which is where the CEO, Brian Moynihan, and another highfalutin vice president named Ann Finnegan live. We had gone there to deliver a letter. We stood there, we gave our IDs, and we wanted to take it up to Ann Finnegan's office, asking them to divest from their really bad, dumb, stupid investments in the coal industry. And a lady on the 32nd floor asked to speak to me and said, well, Ms. Finnegan isn't here. I said, well, that's fine. We'd just like to come up and drop it off to you. Well, that would be fine, but that would mean we would have to send security down to escort you up. And I said, well, we have nothing to hide. That'll be fine. We're just neighbors. Send security down. And she said, well, we'd like to, but there's only one security guy, and we don't know where he is. No, really, I'm not kidding. Old Bob is not making that part up. That was the 32nd floor where Mary Ann was. That was her name, Mary Ann. And I think there was more. There were more than 32 floors to. I didn't get to see. I didn't count or anything. But there were more than 32 floors. And they only had one security guard. One. You know, with an O, an N, and an E. One. I did not channel, you would have been proud of me, I did not channel my inner snark. I did not snipe. But the first thing that occurred to me was, really? One security guard in the bank? I thought up in Boston, not Mayberry. Are you letting him carry his bullet since you know, us activists are down here? You don't know where he is? Is he asleep over in the corner? Is this some sort of a scene out of W.C. Fields' The Bank Dick? It sounded like the setup. It sounds like the setup to a Bruce Willis movie. I could almost imagine Alan Rickman down in the basement saying, "Ah, so we see they have only one security guard." Would you put your money in a bank whose headquarters has only one security guard? When clearly we've been let in the door by two. But anyway, we were told to simply leave our little letter at the visitor's desk and someone would come down and pick it up. Of course, we understood that the someone who was going to come down and pick it up was going to be about 12 hours later, and it was going to be the janitor who was going to pick it up in a trash can and put it in another larger trash can. So we're walking away. Downtown Boston was just fascinating and beautiful to me. And whenever I take these trips, it's sort of, I mean, I acknowledge it. I'm country mouse gone to the city. And I walk around with my head craned upward, you know, and thereby walk into lampposts and things. It hurts. It really does. But as we walked away from Bank of America's Boston Tower, just waiting for Bruce Willis to holler, "Yippee-ki-yay, MF-er," And Boston is like this. There are these plaques on buildings all over the place. You can spend a day or 12 just walking around downtown Boston reading plaques, if you're a history nerd like me. But there at the corner of the building, there was a plaque. I'd stopped to read a previous plaque, and it said something like, on this spot lived Jesuit father, yada, yada, yada. I was like, not interested, and just kept moving. But I stopped and read this one because it was on the corner of where the building that houses the Boston, the giant building that houses the Boston headquarters of Bank of America stood, and it was a bronze plaque that said simply this. Here stood the Long Lane Meeting House, later the Federal Street Church, in which the Massachusetts State Convention voted to ratify the United States Constitution February 6th, 1788. And the American Unitarian Association was organized May 25th, 1825. And William Ellery Channing preached from 1803 to 1842. It was the first part that grabbed my attention. The spot where the Massachusetts delegation made the momentous decision whether or not to ratify the newly drafted Constitution of the United, fledgling United States of America, had been long since torn down, plowed over, buried under, and replaced by a skyscraper temple to corporate excess and rapine. That just nutshelled the whole thing for me. In a place as historic as Boston, not even a place as historic as that, could stand in the way of a massive, monumental temple dedicated to the worship of unholy prophet. But that was Boston, and that was Monday. I should also say that while in Boston, I had a delightful evening with our chat room moderator, Lottie. He and I went out for one of the local delights. This is the food porn portion of the program. One of the local delights, namely the, what are they, Lottie? They're little neck clams, Ipswich clams, I'm told they're called. Lightly battered and flash fried, and they were magnificent. Now, I'm a fried oyster fan, and these were better than any fried oyster that I've ever eaten. It was amazing. On the way back, Lottie showed me some of the sights, and we ran by Revere Beach just so that old Bob could walk out and see the Atlantic Ocean. I'm country mouse, okay? I am. I know it. And because Agnes revels in such things, I picked up two or three great big humongous clamshells to bring back to her. With which she was delighted. On Monday, before I left, Lottie and I went off, because it's always been one of my lifelong dreams. to see the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides. And I did get to see her. Didn't get to go aboard because how was I supposed to know that Monday was the day they closed the ship down for holy stoning the decks and swabbing and mending and all the things that you do aboard a 200-plus-year-old sailing frigate. But even at a distance, she was magnificent and a thrill to the eye. But anyway, I flew one down. I told you a little bit about the fascist security presence in Charlotte. And so I sat there peacefully in my suit. They gave you a little number like you were at a Sotheby's auction, that you raised up your number and you know, got called on. It was really quite efficient. It made sense. And everybody had stood there and said, Mr. Moynihan this and Mr. Moynihan that. And I was looking at him, and for all the Mr. Moynihan-ing going on, it struck me that he probably put his pants on one leg at a time that morning, just like I had. And that despite all his millions, and the fact that he had been a VP at Merrill Lynch before that old institution was driven, corkscrewing, spiraling, nose diving straight into the ground. Sorry, I can't get away from the aircraft imagery here. That he was, for his all and all, just a man. And I finally got recognized, and I stood up. And it was only about a 420-seat auditorium, and I'd already determined that it had pretty good acoustics. And so they had some little functionary with a microphone and also a headset so that it could be relayed to him, you know, have this guy carried out in irons. And they walked over with the microphone to you. And a lot of, you know, because I deal with one of these things on a rather regular basis, they kind of disappear from my view so that I don't feel like that I have to get up here and talk. No, a lot of people do. They feel like they've got to talk right into the microphone. So I just kind of, it was a small space, relatively speaking. And having been trained by, and someday I have to figure out a way to get a note to them or whatever and thank them. Having been trained by some very, very talented, dedicated public school teachers when I was a young boy in the art of projection and making oneself heard and public speaking and all of that stuff. I thought, you know, I don't really need a microphone. So I walked over there and I took a deep breath, filled the and I could hear them. It happens in the diaphragm. It happens in the diaphragm. And I simply said to him, because it was delightful, it's not exactly bucket this is not exactly bucket list material, but I think after the fact I'm probably going to add it to it and check it off just for fun. How often do you get a chance to look at one of the most powerful CEOs in the United States, if not the world, and say, you screwed up and you're wrong and you made a mistake and I'm here to correct you? I got that chance. I got two chances. Because in the course of his remarks, he had said two things. When someone else challenged him on Bank of America persisting in financing the coal industry that is killing people, he said, well, in answer to the question, well, America still gets 50% of its energy from coal. And my pink little ears perked right up. And at another point, he said, I just don't see us changing our position in coal. So I had remarks in my head that I had planned to deliver, I had a way that I wanted to go. But one of the keys in situations like this is to be nimble enough to be able to shift gear and change course. And I did. Larry Gibson, a longtime veteran of the struggle against mountaintop removal, had spoken prior to me and addressed some of the issues I had planned to raise, so I didn't want to simply get up and go over that, you know, and replow that earth. And while I was wondering what I would say, Brian Moynihan, extremely powerful and wealthy member of the 1% and CEO of Bank of America, stepped in those two piles of poo. And the goddess of irony opened the door. And so I got to stand up, and after all that Mr. Moynihan and going on, I'd had about all the Mr. Moynihan I could stand, and I just got up and said, "You made a big old mistake, and I need to correct you before we go any further. You said that 50% of America's energy comes from coal, and Brian, you're wrong. If you will ask any of your bean counters, of whom you have a legion, they will go and look it up and tell you that as of the last numbers, the amount of electricity generated by coal is less than 40% in the United States and falling. And thus, your insistence on persisting in maintaining what you call a position in coal is a position that is by definition untenable and unwise on behalf of your shareholders." And I said, "Brian, you made me sad." Now, bear in mind, we only had 2 minutes. And there was a clock ticking that you could see in front of you just 1 second. They had monitors all over the auditorium, and they would just turn the mic off and walk away. I had a secret weapon. I didn't need the microphone. There was not a person in that room who needed to hear me over the PA. I'm sorry, I'm proud of it. I said, "Brian, you're making me sad. You said you don't see your position in coal changing." I said, "That makes me sad because that means I have to go back to my friends, my neighbors, my colleagues, and my family in Appalachia, in West Virginia, and I have to tell them that Brian Moynihan says he doesn't care whether they live or die. Because when you say something like that, Brian, it's fairly clear you don't. I'm going to cut you some slack, Brian, because I'm going to assume that since you said your position's not going to change, that you haven't read the 19 peer-reviewed studies that have come out in the last 2 years that show that your support, your financing, your enabling of the coal industry is poisoning and killing people all over Appalachia via heart disease, lung disease, pulmonary disorders, genitourinary disorders, and a whole raft of bizarre cancers, not to mention the birth defects that are happening to our unborn in the womb. That you are, in fact, supporting the poisoning of an entire region of this country from the cradle to the grave." And my question for you, Brian, is just this. Do you understand that you, personally, and all of your white-headed and blonde-by-choice board of directors are personally equally responsible for the cancers that stalk our communities? Do you understand that? And if you do understand that, when will you stop financing the coal industry? And I just sat back down. And the room erupted in cheers and applause. And Brian Moynihan who had been none too comfortable the entire time, seeing as how he was the author of the fact that he was in a room that was bristling with deadly firearms. And you never know where the strays might go. I imagine he probably had a Kevlar vest. Bank of America can probably afford those. But what had been nervousness became outright discomfort, and he'd begun to sweat. And you know, I didn't raise my voice. I didn't use any dirty words. I didn't scream at him. Brother Albert, if he's listening, would probably say that I used the command voice without the weirding module. That's tonight's Dune reference. Others spoke equally passionately and equally eloquently. And the beauty of it is that that corporation, if there is no other, has been put on notice by its own shareholders that it owns responsibility for what it is doing. Kim just wrote and said, sounds like the Pinkertons were there, or maybe Blackwater, otherwise known as Z. This particular private security thugs gang was from something called G-Force, G4S, I think. Look them up, I don't know. But they were ready to kill, and they had the guns to prove it. But we got our message across, and of course, after that, we went back. I got out of the suit. I got into my traveling clothes and had that aforementioned harrowing ride back home. And glad I am to be home. Happy I am to be home. To see Agnes as I got off that airplane, and Ferg and William were there with her, was magic. Magic. And so we will have tonight and tomorrow. Let's see, that would be the left 13. And then Monday and Tuesday we will have a show. On the 16th, I head for Wisconsin. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Flying back on the 20th. And then on the strength of what we did in Charlotte, I have been invited. Because it's not just American banks that are funding the poisoning of America, of Appalachian communities. Oh, I have the Bene Gesserit training, Marty. Believe me. Just lucky I didn't have the Gom Jabbar. There's our third Dune reference and our second. On the strength of, it's not just American banks that are funding the destruction of these Appalachian communities. It is also international ones. And I have been invited, and frankly, I hope it works out, because I deem this to be important advocacy that I can't sit here and talk about. I cannot talk the talk if I am not willing to walk the walk. And I have been invited week after next to travel and address the shareholders of both Commerzbank in Frankfurt, Germany, and I want to get this right. I've got the right name. Won't take long. Here we go. Commerzbank in Frankfurt, Germany, and Credit Agricole, or the Societe Generale in Paris. So that may take me away for a little bit longer. After that, we should have some downtime and some work and some time to get some ordinary broadcasting in. But, like I said, this is work that has to be done. It is not that this is secondary. They are both primary. But to a certain extent, this is advocacy radio, and I hope, not that I'm trying to be anyone's inspiration, but I hope that others will be inspired. Because I'm nothing special. I never have held myself out as being some hotshot broadcaster. I'm a guy who was lucky enough to get a DJ job when I was a teenager and fell in love with the medium. If I was driven to be some sort of celebrity broadcaster, I'd have been out there trying to bang on doors and say anything, do anything to get a gig. But I'm quite happy with the little family and growing family that we have built here. But part and parcel of that is that it seems that of late, especially in regard to the work we've been doing in D.C., I have to be away. And I hope you can forgive that, and I hope you don't mind. Meanwhile, an update, I went and got that rotten little Republican in my gut checked out today, and damned if I don't have a happy, healthy gallbladder according to all the testing. So I meet with the surgeon again tomorrow, and we try to figure out just what in the is going on in my guts. But there will be, of course, a Friday on the Front Porch program. Nice note in from Andy. Subject line, beyond fascism. Mr. Bob, that's why I listen. We are beyond fascism. I couldn't agree with your listener more. The U.S. corporate board and corporate governance procedures are a farce. Management almost wields total control, carte blanche, to rape and pillage of the shareholders and the public. We need a National Companies Act to reset the balance in favor of the common good based on a Germanic supervisory board model practiced in Northern Europe. Corporations are supposed to operate at the pleasure, well-being, and benefit of society. In theory, companies are supposed to remain accountable to the government, according to President James Madison. We have moved far beyond any control of the corporate entity because our government has been captured by these same corporate predators. It's long past time we revoke charters and break these bastards up, take back our government. Andy recommends the recent May 4th New York Times piece by Alex Marshall, How to Get Business to Pay Its Share. Solving the Corporate Tax Code Puzzle is part of the link if you want to go and look it up at newyorktimes.com. And there are, you know, there are solutions, but the other side of it is that it is not enough simply to say, let's tear it all to hell and see what comes next. And you'd be surprised to know that there are those who do advocate exactly that. They don't know what they just, it's not that they know so much how they want to proceed or how they want to fix what's broken, as they just want to break what presently exists. And I can't just sit idly by and be down with that. Breaking shit for the sake of breaking it is not the same as fixing things. You know what I mean? While I was down in Charlotte, I was after having given a presentation to some of the folks about mountaintop removal and what it was doing, and the fact that we are working in Washington, D.C. on a fix, this young dude who looked like a young Bobcat Goldthwait, but mercifully didn't sound like him, came up and said, "Dude, you don't really think working with that corrupt Congress is going to change anything, do you? It's all corrupt." And there is corruption in Congress. But I will not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because my response to him was to simply ask, what do you propose I do? Simply lay down and let them kill my children? My grandchildren, my hopes of future progeny beyond that, generations down the road, shall I just sit here and wait for the apocarev to come along? I don't have the money to go and hang out at Chichen Itza until December 23rd, 2012 and see if the shadow still comes down the snake's back. Ah, but this government's like, you know, psy corrupt. Yes, it is. And your solution, please, sir, your solution. Well, you know, we need to break up Bank of America. You know, with like, for like its antitrust violations. I said, oh, you mean using the Sherman Act? And he looked kind of crestfallen. And I said, you mean the Sherman Act that was passed by a Congress that was every bit as corrupt as this one is now? Because the bad money has been in politics for a long, long time. We only think it's the worst it's ever been now because we happen to be living in it. And people living in times tend to think the times they're in are either the best or the worst that they have ever been. Hence, I refer you to one Voltaire and a little piece called Candide, in which he argues through Candide that this is the best of all possible worlds. Or perhaps a Mr. Charles Dickens, who began a book that has been heard of from time to time with the words, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. My new friend from the trip came over and went, dude, do you have any solutions or do you just want to bitch? And kind of grabbed me by the arm and we walked away and he said, I think our ride's here. He's like, I thought you were going to throw a punch. I wasn't. But it is more than a little bit frustrating. We all do our work in the ways that we best can. But there will never be a single piece of legislation formed by a drum circle, as much as I dig drum circles, and I do. Some people have to walk the halls of Congress and beat on doors until they are heard. And to simply say, well, I'm not going to do that because they're too corrupt, when in fact not everyone in that Congress is corrupt, and you work with the good to create the better. I mean, it just needs to, like, all fall apart, Mom. So that's roughly, in a little over an hour, the story of my most recent adventure. And many thanks, many, many thanks, many sincere and hearty thanks to those who made it possible. Our friends at the Rainforest Action Network, in particular, and the people on the ground, folks like Monique and Pete and Annie and Kay Rule, who took what could have been utterly chaotic situations and made them seem as calm as a Sunday stroll. Thanks to you all. This is, however, something we do call conversation radio, not talk radio, conversation radio, in which the emphasis is not on my blathering, but on our discussion, our dialogue, our problem solving, our seeking for answers. And you know how to reach the program, I trust. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. 304-658-3333 is the direct dial number. Now, you said you were going to tune in, Kristen. Are you out there? I just love the notion of having a listener in Wyoming or somewhere. Or California. Wherever you happen to be right now. Oh, she's a dandy. So we will open up the lines for conversation in short order. It is Thursday, and therefore I'm tickled to have a Green News report available for us from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And we'll go to that and then come back to your calls, your conversation, your expertise here on the Horn, America's listener-supported liberal voice. Me, I'm Bob Kincaid.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, May 10, 2012.
We take measures that will help facilitate and maintain power in the event of an interruption of the commercial grid.
Cyber attacks underway on U.S. natural gas pipelines.
If I'm president, I can tell you I'm going to be committed to all the energy, whether it comes above the ground or below the ground.
Mitt Romney makes big promises to big oil.
Coal is crime. Do not let it come through this community.
Bobby Kennedy Jr. fights big coal in Portland.
He has had nothing to do with bringing the gas price down the last few days. He's had everything to do with pushing the gas price up over the last 3 years.
Schizophrenic Fox News now says lower gas prices are a bad thing. Plus, It's official. The last 12 months in the U.S. were the hottest 12 months on record.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Earlier this week, engineers announced plans to drill the deepest undersea well ever drilled. 12,000 feet deep. They say it will make it possible for companies to drill into the mantle of the Earth.
Awesome! What could possibly go wrong? This is your Green News Report. You know, Des, hearing Rachel Maddow talk about this new plan to drill into the mantle of the Earth, I'm reminded of the old 1950s Superman TV show. Remember that? The Mole Men, where actually creatures from inside the Earth came up through an oil well?
Oh, goody. I can't wait to see if that comes true.
Yeah, well, anyway, I guess that's one bad thing that probably won't happen. Everything else, who knows?
Yes. Apparently, the Fox News Brain Trust thinks you're too stupid to notice that last month they said President Obama is completely responsible for high gas prices at the pump. But now that gas prices are dropping, they say President Obama is not at all responsible. Even more schizophrenically, now Fox News is trying to spin that falling gas prices are a bad thing.
Prices are falling, but before you start cheering, we're going to talk about why lower prices at the pump could actually be bad news.
Bad news for people who don't want to see Barack Obama win a second term, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Bad news for the oil industry's profits and for Republicans who want to use it as a campaign bludgeon. Earlier this week, we reported on the unprecedented speech by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta acknowledging the national security impact of climate change. Secretary Panetta laid out the Pentagon's aggressive investment strategy in renewable energy technology and also investment in protecting the nation's power grid, water, and communications systems against cyber attacks. What Secretary Panetta did not tell his audience is that the U.S. natural gas pipeline industry is currently undergoing a months-long cyber attack right now.
Wonderful.
The Christian Science Monitor reports that a major cyber attack is currently underway at computer networks run by the U.S. natural gas pipeline industry. That's according to confidential alerts issued by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security since December, warning the industry to beef up security against intrusion. While the U.S. military is deeply invested in renewable energy to save lives and money, Republican Mitt Romney is going all in for big oil. At a campaign stop in an oil field in Colorado on Wednesday, the presumptive GOP presidential nominee reassured his major campaign donors from big oil that his all-of-the-above strategy really means an all-of-the-below. Drilling everywhere.
So what I would do if I were president is take advantage of the energy resources we have and that we can find. I'm going to open lands for exploration. I'm going to expand leases on western land, not cut them back by 75%. I'm going to open up ANWR. I'm going to get drilling in the Gulf going again.
And I'm going to drill for mole men in the mantle of the Earth.
Noticeably absent from Mitt Romney's list of energy sources we have and we can find are wind, solar, and geothermal. All sources that the military seems to think are pretty important. Activists in Portland are fighting to stop big coal.
Anybody who touches coal gets poisoned by it. And you don't just get sick. It poisons your democracy, it poisons your community, it poisons your values.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spoke at a rally over the weekend to protest against a proposed new coal shipping terminal that would vastly increase coal exports out of the United States and vastly increase local air pollution for residents from dust from uncovered coal trains.
I've seen this movie before. They make these promises in advance. They say they're going to bring prosperity. They say they're going to do it safely this time. Once they get that permit, I guarantee you not a single one of those cars will ever be covered.
The U.S. coal industry is trying to force through new coal export terminals on the West Coast to export its dirty fuel to China because coal is losing huge market share to cleaner-burning natural gas in the United States. Meanwhile, the consequences of burning more fossil fuels continue. It's official. The last 12 months in the United States were the hottest 12 months on record, the hottest 12-month stretch in 117 years.
The hottest 12 months on record since 1895.
That's according to NOAA, who says we are probably well on our way to breaking that just-broken record again in coming months, as the exceptionally warm winter we just had points to a hot and dry summer.
For more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
The mole people, they live in a hole, people. Deep down in the earth, they've dug a busy world of their own. Listen, you'll hear them chomping, diddy, chomping, diddy, chomping, diddy, chomping, diddy, chomping.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Well, or at least 37 and a half minutes with your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox. Thanks, B-Red. I'm Bob. Good morning. See, that's the generational difference. I wasn't found in the 50s, so I didn't remember the mole man. Oh, when I think about drilling into the mantle of the earth, drilling past the earth's crust, I think about, you know, Holly. And all those terrifying run-ins with the sleestaks on the land of the lost. Right? Now it is. It's 23 minutes past the hour, and the filibuster is hereby concluded, and we will go straightway to the phones if anyone has actually had the patience to hang on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there from Tucson.
Oh, fancy. How's it going?
Oh, long lost. You're long lost, Tucsonan. Hi. Listen, what an adventure you had, and how proud we are of you.
Well, thank you.
And now, to top it off, I have figured out how we're going to make our fortune.
Yes? Oh, do tell.
I have it, you and me, and then all our other hornies out there that will franchise for their local markets. It hit me this morning listening to Stephanie and some of her callers who are really, really pissed that marriage is not going to be the exclusive, the privilege there of one man, one woman. And so it occurred to me that, yeah, we can, you know how a signature has a certain amount of legal value, but
certainly,
a notarized signature has even more of a legal value, but a medallion signature, whoa, big time. So I think we're going to start doing medallion marriages, which are very, very hard to get, and for only a few $100, one man, one woman can get a medallion marriage certified by us with our own little certificate. And we, of course, we won't let any gays and lesbians. No. Just qualified. One man, one woman can have a medallion marriage. And one of the factors of medallion marriage, because we will have very, 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 very low divorce rates on medallion marriages, because one of the documents that you would sign is that in the future, if either member of the couple initiates divorce proceedings, they automatically relinquish any claim to community property. So you see how low our divorce rates would be.
Absolutely.
Now, we may have a problem with murder rates.
See, I was just thinking about that.
You know, I couldn't think of the word. I can't think of the word of spousicide. You know, there's patricide, matricide, matricide. What happens when you kill a spouse? What's that called legally?
Isn't that maricide? No.
I would think, yeah, it's spousicide I've been working with. But you think I got a plan?
I think you've got a plan.
Yeah, I think we can all make our wealth by appealing to those people who are so offended that just anybody can get married by having their marriage solemnized by our marriage plan.
The right-wing silliness that has attended this has just been, I would say stunning, but I'm not stunned anymore. But it has reached new levels of the stupid. Let's see, the Catholic League tweeted yesterday, Tom and Dick fall in love, and while they are courting, they run into Harry. Harry wants to marry Tom and Dick also. Why shouldn't it be okay? And my answer is, you know, I really can't answer that except you want to do the polyandry thing, go ask the Mormons and ask them why.
I don't have a problem with that.
Frankly, I don't either. I think it gets a little mathematically complicated after a while, but...
No, you know what? Years ago, one of my closest friends was in a mariage, and it was Sonny, it was Lynn, and it was Robert. And I remember sitting on the porch with Sonny one day, and I said, Sonny, I'm married, and just dealing with one partner is tricky enough. How the hell do you guys do it with three? And he said something, he said, one of the interesting things is the dynamics are constantly changing. And I just sort of stayed with me that, yeah, I guess you have a whole new dynamic to deal with, but it worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it would work for others, but it worked for them. And partly is...
But you can say that about a plain vanilla marriage, too, can't you? I don't know if it will work for others, and apparently it doesn't work for roughly 50% of the people who try it, but it worked for them.
But our medallion marriages, that we wouldn't have divorce.
No. But there is that homicide.
If you had to relinquish...
There's that little homicide problem.
Property, we might. We're going to have to figure a way to deal with it. Yeah, we might. If possible. Spousal disappearance among... medallion marriages.
Didn't the right-wingers have something a few years ago that Mike Huckabee was all wrought about? Wasn't that called the covenant marriage? Wasn't that what that was?
Yes. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
And they actually enacted that into law in the state of Arkansas. Fritz can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they did.
Isn't that special?
Yeah, it's entirely voluntary, but you promise to, I don't know, be waterboarded or something if you think about divorce, or just something icky and fundamentalist.
Yeah, I think the exclusivity of marriage is rather an odd thing to start with. It's absurd. What has happened is just absurd.
Well, and it was a little revolting because our hotel in Charlotte was just off of Billy Graham Parkway. Which incidentally, I couldn't help noting on the way to the airport, is neither straight nor narrow fancy. There's that 93-year-old huckster rising up from his bed
Billy's kind of lost contact with this world, and his son channels him. So we're not sure whether this was Billy's statement. He'd never in the past, brought up.
Well, I don't know if the never in the past, because remember, there are those tapes of him sitting around in the Oval Office with Richard Nixon as the paranoid Nixon sat there babbling, well, Billy, the problem with America is the Jews. It's the Jews, Billy. That's right, Mr. President. God bless you for recognizing it. They just need the healing grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. The Jews do, but they deny Christ, Billy. They deny Christ. So... I've never had that pure as the driven snow opinion of old Billy. No. And it's funny, one of the things I noticed as I was going through, oddly enough, the security checkpoint in Charlotte to get out onto the concourses, there was the Billy Graham Library. It's an experience that will transform you. I'm thinking, why would I ever... want to go? Who would want to go to the Billy Graham Library? What's in there? I mean, we know there aren't any real biology books. We know there aren't any real science books. We know that there aren't any fact-based books. I'm sure there's lots of books about how Belzubalar knew Shadrina and brought forth... But who would ever give a damn about anything in the Billy Graham Library?
And it came to pass, yeah.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
And it, yeah, and it came to pass because on second down, the trap play didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I was so pleased yesterday with just the president's statement.
Well, I was too.
And I think it's going to change. I was pickle tink with Vice President, blank out she goes, the other day when he made his statement.
Vice President Biden, yeah.
Biden, you know, just hooray for you, good dude.
Yes.
And, you know, and we all know that same-sex marriage is not an if, it's a when. It's going to happen.
Yeah, well, just marriage, just marriage equality. There's, it shows the desperation of these bigots' position. What if they want... Because the other thing they use besides three guys, and of course they're trying to leverage the icky factor, because they can't think about... All they think about is sex. It's like the Virgin Mandy in Life of Brian. Sex, sex, sex. It's all you ever think about. Sex. Is it too big? Is it too small? Will the girls like it? That's what the right wing... Because the right wing can't stop thinking about actual physical sex. It's on their mind all the time. But the fact of the matter, it's just... No one has ever said anything about polyandry or bigamy. You know, I got two spouses and it's mighty bigamy. They just... It's all about... Because the other thing they trot out is, well, what's going to happen to America after these homos can get married? What's going to happen when a man wants to marry his chicken?
Well, as long as it's an adult consenting chicken.
See? And see, that's why we get in trouble. It's those progressive liberal people like you fancy okay with chicken marriage. Well, what's next? Worms? Yeah. They're just awful. The ironic hypocrisy award has to go to the log cabin Republicans, because this had to be a conundrum for them, right? You know, you can buy those conundrums for 50 cents on the wall of the bathroom.
I wonder where I put my old conundrum.
Right.
I had one.
I had one that was passed down through generations that had three legs and it was moss covered.
My grandmother's conundrum. Oh, you got it.
But if Barack Obama really chooses now to support marriage equality, he doesn't deserve praise for being a day late and a dollar short. This from the log cabin Republicans that most of the Republican Party would like to just see die.
That this is our chance to just make it big. We can create the world's most exclusive marriage, you know, and anybody willing to pay for it can get certified by us.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, we have an answer to our vocabulary question.
Oh, what is it called when one murders their spouse?
Well, Ron and Raleigh notes that there is not a word for generic spouse killing, but when one kills one's husband, one is committing maricide, and when one kills one's wife, one is committing uxoricide. And Ron notes,
Ron,
don't use those often, do we?
The room, isn't he?
Pardon?
Wow, thank you, Ron.
Yeah. Uxoricide and maricide.
How amazing.
And I don't know what happens if you spray it on your petunias.
Why take it with your conundrum?
Generally on an empty stomach.
not a good idea. So they're going to let you keep your gallbladder?
Well, I don't know. I have to talk to the doc tomorrow. He may look at me and say, listen, you know, it can look like it's healthy, but it can still be tormenting you, so...
My son finally came down with the faulty family gallbladder. My sister lost hers at age 14. I had managed to hold on to mine until I was about 20, 21 or so. And of course, luckily, he was and still is. He's an expat. He lives in Germany. So he got complete care. Everything. Soup, whatever.
People remove the offending gallbladder now. Yeah.
They removed the offending gallbladder, and he didn't even have a copay.
Jesus.
He had excellent care.
I think about trying to crank out $5,000 for it. Oh God.
Honey, it would have bankrupted him.
Well, today's test of my gallbladder, which it passed. I like passing tests. I'm just a funny little academic that way. Today's test was $800. So
yeah.
I'll be writing $10 a month for 80 months.
And the only problem that my son had, and he's a vegetarian, and in a German hospital, they weren't quite sure what to feed him. And he said he kind of had the matrons a little bit baffled, and one of the matrons was explaining to him that sausage really wasn't meat. And he's about the time that
God, I love. There are moments where you just love German culture, aren't there? This is not really me.
Just about the time they were getting it figured out for him, a Muslim came into the hospital and really confused them. So, how strange and wonderful is that?
And you know, it's kind of funny. While we were traveling, a number of our traveling companions and our hosts were vegetarian. And my new friend Lowell from Montana and I kept finding, it just seemed strange that every time we had a meal, there just happened to be somewhere in Cambridge a vegetarian restaurant nearby. And we were on the verge of some sort of meat deprived psychosis.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there are these things. I mean, I had a breakfast one morning that had something called Satan in it. No, really. It was S-A-I-T-E-N, but it was Satan. And they all said, oh, it's just like meat. Well, maybe it's just like meat if you don't eat meat. But as a meat eater, I can tell you, it ain't nothing like meat. It doesn't taste bad.
Yeah,
it's made out of, like, straight 200-proof wheat gluten or something, but it's not just like me. I had a lovely omelet made with it and some fresh arugula in it and Vermont cheddar and it was delightful. It was yummy. I mean, I ate it with gusto and relish and mustard.
I look like a little gusto on the side and
yeah, yeah, and the mustard back, right?
Yeah, you got it, buddy.
So we finally got to Carolina, and I looked at Lowell, my new buddy, and I said, okay, I think we can find something to eat here. Carolina barbecue. On the day we left, after I got dropped at the airport, they got taken to a barbecue joint, and I'm sitting there on the airplane when I get a texted photograph from Lowell saying, we have found the mother load, and it's this huge plate of chopped pork with vinegar sauce on it and a rack of ribs back. The young man was absolutely meat deprived, and I think he was, I just have this mental image of him, you know, just getting the meat off and just... pulling out that polished, clean rib and setting it nicely on the edge of the plate.
Good Lord. Yeah, I grew up in Texas. We had meat several times. We had beef several times a week. And I've tried to go vegetarian a number of times, and I said, I always find I'm just suddenly I have this urge to gnaw on my bedroom slipper or my belt.
I'm a hillbilly, and I like it, but I have an abiding love for, you know, carnivorous things. I can't imagine being a Montana boy. And what? Where's the meat? Yeah. This is Montana. Everybody has their own personal cow, don't they? No, I'll get a snarky email from Kate saying, no, we're not just out here gnawing on the ankles of the bovines for the fun of it.
Apparently the human body's quite adaptable, but I've never been able to make that adaptation and stay with it for any length of time. Now, that's a strange thing.
No, I freely acknowledge that most of us would do dramatically better to significantly reduce our meat intake, especially given factory farming and all of that stuff. It's icky. But cold turkey is different. See, we can't even talk about quitting meat without talking about meat some more. Cold turkey ain't easy.
Yeah, true. I like cold turkey.
With a pickle? With a pickle? Absolutely.
I told you about my son breaking his vegetarianism one year. He was, you know, he travels, and he was in Lapland. And he wrote me a note, and he said, you know, he says, I broke it because I wanted to taste reindeer. He says, really not worth the trip. So I wrote him a little note back, and I said, Christmas will be a little less this year due to that unfortunate incursion with Blitzen.
Oh, indeed.
Like, I hate reindeer. How weird is that?
Reindeer would have to be a little gamey, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even the whitetail around here has a kind of a flavor, especially if you didn't shoot it right and it goes running off and you have to hunt it and drag it back to camp.
He ate Blitzen.
Yeah.
That's just too much a part of our...
With a side of Donder.
How sad is that? Well, love to everybody. And,
absolutely. I'm so glad to hear from you. It's been too long. You're doing okay?
Yeah. I'll tell you I got a note from a close friend in Hawaii, and he says, it's time you stop bitching about your age and start bragging about it.
Hear, hear.
So, I am. But one of the unfortunate realities of reaching a certain age and living is that your contemporaries don't. And I've had some sadness and some loss and some sitting in, I've seen way too much hospital this year. I'm losing folks.
Yeah.
And that's my new answer when people say, how are you? And I say, better than I deserve. Because I didn't do anything to take... I wasn't real good at taking care of myself, If there was something I hadn't tried, just let me at it. And so that's a little process of maturing. And I'm really grateful I made it to this day.
Oh, by the way, I'm told that stuff inside my omelet is pronounced Satan. I don't know if it looked on the menu like Satan, so.
Close enough.
You know, on Sunday we eat Jesus, and on Tuesday we have Satan.
We eat Satan.
In the Mormon pantheon, remember, they're both brothers, so keeping it all in the family.
That's true. That's true. That's true. The brothers of... We're going to get to know a lot more about LDS than we ever thought we wanted to, I think.
Or ever actually wanted to. I'm pretty sure I don't want to. But we're going to learn about it anyway.
Yeah, I got a feeling we're going to get, you know, the quickie course in LDS coming down.
Oh, life on
Kolob. Oh, well.
Life on Kolob. Good night, Hezekiah boy.
You're so bad. Good night now.
Take care, Fancy. Bye.
Bye-bye, sweetie.
Life was good up on Kolob Mountain. They would come. The big family would all say goodnight. Goodnight, Daddy Man. Goodnight, Matriarch Woman. Goodnight, Hezekiah Boy. Goodnight, Uriah Girl. And another day would come to Kolob Mountain. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program. Yeah, it sounds like nobody home. I miss my busy signal. Hey, welcome to the program. And you're gone too. Hey, welcome to the program. Is this thing even working? now. You know, it's a phone system that's something approaching 9 years old. So, well, that's... Yeah. But, yeah, Marty says something for fancy. My uncle likes to say, if I knew I'd live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. He's in his 80s, which is a good sign. Although I must admit, I was saddened to hear the passing of Maurice Sendak. Those of us who waited for the Where the Wild Things Are in first grade. Someone is gone from our world. All right, let's try this. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, what's up?
It's Chris from the Nano.
Oh, I know. What's happening?
Oh, geez. Well, you might try Skype, you know. That's a definitive pass-fail on it.
Well, the audio has thus far proved kind of dodgy with Skype.
Unfortunately, yeah, it's very bandwidth-dependent, and if you have issues with bandwidth, that's not exactly a good thing.
But I think it'll come along over time, and there are expensive pieces of equipment you can use to make Skype really, really accessible.
Yep. But hopefully it's a very high-speed internet connection, at which point it all becomes nice and happy, and the moment you start giving them money, they're very happy to turn on the extra error correction and such.
Right.
This reactor 4, it's not actually reactor 4, it's the fuel pool at 4, has been coming up more and more in the news, and it's just getting...
Yeah, in Fukushima?
Yeah. First of all, just a sort of a recount, we're not really, really sure at the end of the day. We can't really get any kind of corroboration or confirmation. What TEPCO says and what the videos show and what reporters who have been there and people who work there say all seem to be pointing in exactly opposite directions, which you think there'd only be two, but there's apparently an infinite number of directions they could be pointing in. So as far as there's four reactors on site, four was completely unloaded into the fuel pool, so all its stuff, the new stuff and the old stuff, was all in that fuel pool. And it's got a lot of old stuff there. They don't have a storage facility, just like we don't. So there's lots of it there to have bad things happen to. But nothing's really happened to that one so far. That's sort of a... They had a leak. I believe they had a small explosion there, but the big one was at 3. There was another explosion at 2, and something nasty happened to 1. They lost cooling and it's starting to melt down. But, no, 1 and 4 didn't blow up, 2 and 3 did. And 1, 2, and 3 are in, they had fuel in the reactors and they had stuff in the fuel pools. The confusing part is, because of the explosions and the flooding and all this other good stuff, we can't tell whether it was the fuel pool or the reactors that went at any of these. Not really. We've got some indications that it was one, some indications that it was the other.
It is pretty clear that it's a damn scary mess, though, right?
Oh, God, yeah. It's like a 9.0, so to speak. The thing is, they got to be thinking big. And right now, the scariest thing is that Japanese equivalent to a teabagger government, a TEPCO, which is the equivalent of the teabag party itself. It's just as corrupt and stupid as it's possible to be and still function. Corrupt as the day is long. They're like the Department of Homeland Security, actually hiring on criminals to do legitimate work. I'm not being euphemistical here. I mean, they actually...
No, I know you're not.
...and organize criminals and such, that do their HR and such. It's terribly, terribly, terribly creepy. Ford is sort of teetering. The whole building's shifting off to one side because you got this big heavy thing there. And you used to have it balanced by this reactor on the other side and all this other stuff. But apparently the whole foundation on that thing's been shattered. They've tried to plug up holes before, and it doesn't work, apparently. And the neat thing is we're having all our carefully cherished sacred cows destroyed. All those things we were supposed to be told were going to save us from nuclear calamity. There's the boron pellets that they interspace the fuel in the fuel rods with so that they expand and absorb neutrons so that they drop below criticality as it gets hotter. Apparently that didn't work, or it didn't work well enough. or there was no boron. They just stuffed it full of fuel like they weren't supposed to. Again, given...
No, they wouldn't do that, would they?
Given TEPCO's track record, we have no idea. And there's no way to confirm it unless somebody wants to pull one of these things out of their backyard and go and take a look-see and die of radiation poisoning about 6 seconds later. These things are as radioactive as it's possible to have on the surface of a planet. These 3 and 2, when they blew out, we think those were the pools. If they were the pools, it was so much worse than it could have been for the reactor. The pools are full of the daughter products of fission. Not only do they have low-grade uranium now in them, instead of high-grade uranium, and lots of it, so it fuses and it produces a lot of power. An old reactor is different from a new reactor in that an older reactor has lots of daughter products, it's got old fuel, not so much uranium, it's burnt off and turned into other things. And about 10% of the power of any given reactor comes from the daughter products after it's been running for a while. That's the reason Three Mile Island didn't actually melt down. It got down to the bottom of the reactor, but it didn't go any farther than that. Because it was a very new reactor, it didn't have much daughter products, and it just melted, then sort of gave up the ghost and stopped. Now we're hoping this scales up, that daughter products, there's just not enough daughter products there to really go all too deep under that reactor, but as long as it's digging, as long as it's melting, any kind of water, whether that's groundwater or water they spray on, is going to end up in steam, it's going to vaporize, and of course having molten metal around, just like having molten water around in the form of liquid water. Some of it evaporates, some of it vaporizes, some of it sublimes from the surface. You're going to get the stuff being dumped in the atmosphere in increasing quantities. Now, you're not talking tons and tons. That would require another explosion, but when you've got this stuff happening, all this molten stuff at the bottom, some of it's going to be the zinc chloral alloy, and that's going to be heating up, and if any water hits that, you've got the possibility of more hydrogen production and further explosions. This thing could just keep exploding again and again and again and again. Just from groundwater. It'd almost be safer to let it go dry, except that having this stuff just purely vaporize out of the reactor core would be...
Yeah, that gets troublesome.
Yeah, but if they've got this theory about putting a blanket over the whole damn thing, and if they could actually do that, come up with a large-scale site solution, that might actually do it. You see, a lot of the problems when you uncover a reactor core, whether it explodes or it's melting down or just a regular old reactor. Nothing's bad's happened to it. You just chop the roof off for some reason and drain the pool down to the point where the bundles get exposed is the gamma rays. They go up, and gamma rays are highly reactive. They hit anything, and they just turn into more gamma rays, and they spread out. But they go up, and then they sort of bounce off the atmosphere because the atmosphere is pretty thick for a gamma ray. That's why we don't have to worry about gamma rays from the sun so much.
Right.
And then
the UV is plenty.
Back, most of them bounce back to the planet itself in and around the area, decreasing with the distance from it. So it's sort of like city glow effect, except it's invisible light and it kills you, which can make the entire area so radioactive that nobody can even approach it just because of the city glow, the evil city glow of this nuclear Ginza. Gamma.
Oh, good phrase, nuclear Ginza.
Yeah, that's a great little backgrounder on the nuclear power industry in Japan. It's a lovely documentary showing how they hired on Yakuza to run their HR departments, which brought in literally street people.
Oh, what? Yeah, I remember. You know, I saw some of that. I remember talking with Sandra about it one night.
Yeah, it's infinitely evil. These guys are dying of radiation burns all over them, and not a single nuclear power company in the country will own up to actually having hired them at any point.
Yeah, they just wandered in and said, we want to work on the reactor.
Or they spontaneously cold fuse or something.
Yeah.
Again, you know, like Nitro or something off of Marvel Comics. The other issue is the contamination. Again, I was talking to Mike last night about bars to pass for end-of-the-world scenarios. It doesn't matter if, you know, it blows up and cracks the planet and destroys us, if, you know, just it being open to the air kills us. The bars for nuclear calamities tend to be in the range of, you know, there's three ways you can get it. Either direct radiation exposure, you just, all your cells die, at which point any other problems you have that day are just ended. Cancer induction. Your immune system is suppressed by all this radiation around, and so the inevitable mutations caused by the radiation, direct radiation exposure, cause you to die. The next part down is contamination, little hot particles get in, and the cell right beside that hot particle is getting millions of servits, but against background radiation or the entirety of your body, it doesn't even register. So it's, oh, you're fine, there's no radiation coming from you, except for that one hot particle that blends into the background, which that one cell sitting beside that hot particle is seeing an awful lot of these days. It's an unholy relationship.
Well,
then there's the
there's a sort of symbiosis that occurs in my mind, Chris. I hear this, and then I think about the story that Brad and Desi had in the Green News Report a little bit earlier in the hour, where they were talking about the plan to drill the deepest undersea oil well in all of all time, allowing them to reach the mantle. With all jokes about slee stacks and mole people aside, that can't be good.
It might actually be very good.
Really?
Yeah. Screw the oil. If you can drill into the mantle itself, you've got a power tap that, you know, they talk
about. Oh, geothermal energy, yeah.
Geothermal energy. And all of a sudden, you can tap a heat reserve that's unparalleled. I've looked at the geomaps of North America, a mining engineer. Basically, what you want to do is, if you're going to set one of these things up, you want to do it on the thinnest mantle you can. And that happens over seabed. Seabed is the thinnest. Everywhere else, it gets thicker, harder, all kinds of bad things. And you want it as deep under the seabed as possible, so in a Marianas Trench. But now, you don't want this thing subducted when there's inevitably an earthquake. So preferably, long-term talking, you want it away from seismically active zones, you want it on seabed. You want deep sea, about 2-3 miles down in the water. And you want the facility as close to the thermal requirement as possible. You can send the power up via electric lines, but you want the actual facility as close as possible so you don't have to insulate the pipes going up and down as any more necessary, so you don't lose power from bleed. But then you've got all that lovely seawater just hanging around, oh, everywhere to dump the extra heat to. The extra heat being dumped into the sea will make a local thermocline, which will make all the local fish and corals and all that happy. You don't have to worry about stuff growing on your heat dump apparatus, but well, that's what jobs are for, right? Some guy going out there with a hammer, hammering off the corals. And well, he's got a good job, and it's going to last forever because there's always going to be coral, and there's always going to be heat in the power of the plant's thermal output.
But do they? I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing, though. I mean, did they think there's oil in the mantle?
Maybe they believe in this abiotic oil. It all just
right. Little Keebler
well,
is making it.
The thing is, yeah. You can get oil reserves out of deep drilling on the continent, but not offshore. There's a possibility of tapping into the heat reserves of the plant to do a metamorphic conversion of the calcites that get subducted, but that's not even theoretically. That's a real Pandora's box, because if you get a blowout at that angle, at the angle the mantle's at the conditions of the mantle being as disrupted as it is anywhere on the planet, you don't want to be screwing around with that. You could literally just blow out a couple hundred square miles of seabed and it all comes up into a new volcano, and the tsunami from that would be spectacular. Just because we literally don't know what could be let loose by that. And when you don't know, you plan for the worst. You use the wild-ass guesses. You know, and if your wild-ass guesses are in the realm of theoretically possible, just for, you know, what's the average rock breakage for this pressure at that climb and this particular mineral, that's what mining engineers do, you know. They figure out how deep a tunnel you can drive and how big a tunnel and how it's got to be shaped and what kind of protection you got to put in so it doesn't collapse on the nice miner before he gets the mineral you want. This is, you know, civil engineering. This is mining engineering. Now, civil engineers do it so that it lasts forever. Mining engineers tend to do it long enough to get the hell out again.
Right.
Their stuff, then they get out. And then they allow it to subduct down, which really pisses off municipalities ahead of, above them. So if they do.
Well, and you know, it's mining engineers who design these dirt and slate rubble dams that hold back multiple billions of gallons of toxic waste down here in southern West Virginia and all over central Appalachia. And the thing is, yeah, they're engineers. Those things are not engineered on a 500-year basis. They're sure not engineered on a 1,000-year basis. And because they're made of dirt, it doesn't, you know, bode well.
Well, with those, the best way to make a dam of any sort is to have it tiered. So if a dam fails, it's not going to kill all the dams downstream. It'll just be a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. What you want is 1,000 of these damn things going up, and you have a little bit in each one.
But that's not the way it works here, because they're not necessarily holding back a stream. They're holding back toxic waste.
Well, the thing is, if you had a toxic waste impoundment just down the hill of them that went up about halfway up their dam wall, all of a sudden that impoundment becomes terribly stable.
No, but that's not how they do it.
No,
I mean, no, they just built.
Going up the
they built. They it's these things are unlined, Chris. They sit on. You know that subduction you were talking about a minute ago? Well, the biggest dam in the Western Hemisphere is in Raleigh County, West Virginia. It's the Brushy Fork Impoundment, and it sits on top of an area that has been vastly undermined, in which the pillars have collapsed, at least some of them. And the entirety of the old mine is full of water, or, you know, toxic waste now. And it's got 9 billion gallons of water pressing down on top of it, held back by the aforesaid dirt and slate mining waste dam.
That's just a recipe for, you know, if you wanted to get the specifically the stuff that they first dumped into the impoundment, which was going to run probably be the most toxic waste they had. The first stuff they loaded in, if you wanted to get that into the groundwater as fast and efficiently as possible, burying it is actually one of the best ways to do it. Running water over it improves that by orders of magnitude. Making sure all the ground underneath it is shattered and fractured as possible to improve the circulation even better. So what actually improves the impoundment to prevent it from sliding down the hill, the fracturing and the drainage and all that, actually makes it toxify the groundwater even more. And when you're talking impoundment dams, because they're lined, you don't have to worry about ACL contamination so much. You still have to mix them with a bit of cement in order to basically turn them into a giant brick so that even if the wall fails, it's, well, it's a brick. It's not going anywhere. They might slide to a side or another, and that would be kind of inconvenient for the one guy who had a house right beside the dam. But, you know, in general, the community's pretty...
Now, the engineering study for failure on this thing says that when it goes... a wall of toxic waste 40 to 60 feet high is going to travel down the Coal River Valley for about 100 miles.
Plan on going farther. I've worked with those studies before. I've talked to them, and they usually lowball it. The one that was done for that Hungarian one that flooded the Danube said it would be, you know, a four-foot wall. It wouldn't be a problem. It might strike the opposing village, but probably not. It's all really viscous stuff, and it wouldn't even move. If it did move, it'd probably be a slump failure, not a catastrophic, not a ravining failure mode. All kinds of sweet, fluffy talk. Don't believe it as far as you can spit. The reality is always worse. And there's always something we fail to add into our calculations. We like to think we know what we're doing, but it's an approximation of reality. It's not the actuality. Well, and getting back to Fukushima and off subjects that are just terribly depressing... you know, the problem is, you know, with the impoundment curtailment dams, that requires humans to actually work in their best interest, and that just doesn't happen anymore. Whereas Fukushima, that's an engineering problem, and it's possible to be solved with money and work. With Fukushima, if they could literally start at least setting up the foundations for a giant dome to go over the whole site to reduce the problem.
Right.
You know, the ability to mitigate, that would be a long way. And having some cranes on the inside, and nobody's talking hydraulic robots. I mean, they've had a few robots in there, and they're crap. In high radiation environments, they get eaten alive. Oh, they're shielded. It doesn't matter. You have to run these things on umbilicals. The umbilicals get interfered with in high radiation environments. And there's when I've looked at the cleanup site, oh, look at all the stuff we've cleaned up. Well, yeah, you've moved a few big pieces about, but you haven't cleaned up the dust. You haven't cleaned up the dirt. You have no dirt curtailment plan whatsoever. The first thing you do at a site of any cleanup, whether it's asbestos or whatever, is you start putting in roads, make sure they're nice and tamped down and all paved and good stuff so you can get the heavy equipment in. And you clean up the little stuff first because it's the easiest, and you work your way into the site. You don't go into the site and just clear out a few corridors as you come across them. And you sure as hell like these idiots keep trying to push on the Japanese government reopening the site. They don't have a single reactor that works except the one at four. That one would work, but...
And it's teetering.
Yeah, it's teetering. The whole damn building's going off. Oh, I don't know, because detonations nearby and tsunamis and earthquakes that turn the land into jello. Anybody, you know, seriously, at the first mention of the word nuclear power in Japan, somebody should have been shot. And it's just criminal, absolutely criminal. The place is a walking earthquake.
Yes.
And you don't build things that don't respond well to vibration on earthquake zones. I mean, nobody else in the universe except possibly California gets more bloody earthquakes. Well, Europa, I hope, but Earthbound. No,
right.
There's nowhere else.
Yeah, the rock.
Exactly. And, yeah, there's just no... Unless you've got a floating Russian nuclear reactor, which they are still selling, believe it or not, even then, you know, well, what happens when your nuclear reactor that's floating on that nice big barge gets swept away by a tsunami? Right. Because when you look at these tsunami pictures, they're just shocking to look at. The thing it reminds me of is those horrible floods that happened in Quebec a while ago, about 10 years ago. You see it, and it's just walls of water flowing down hills and across, you know... giant boils of water bubbling up like a class 9 rapid or something like that. And if you start thinking of a tsunami in the form of, oh, we've got a class 1 rapid right on top of our town, it's going to happen for, oh, a day. Hey, the survivability of stuff people make just goes out the bloody window. But I got a bit off the field there.
No, that's you really didn't.
The stuff that's going to kill us, you know, going down that whole list, you got the radiation contamination that will give you cancer. The lowest bar of all, and the one that's the most horrific, because it has the most emotional cost, most civilization cost, is the one that says, this is the contamination that turns all your kids into mutants. And it's not, oh, cool, X-Men. This is the ones where they're born without stuff they're going to miss.
Or their brains outside their skulls.
Teratogenesis and the... can't remember all the names of it. Teratogenesis is the one I remember specifically for uranium. And that just prevents them from growing things like arms, lungs, hearts, just big bits they need, not there. It just chunks out whole parts of the development process. And just the other part, this thing is dumping tons of heavy metals into the atmosphere, just like the, honestly, just like the Chinese industrial effort. It's dumping lots of heavy metals into the atmosphere. And heavy metals have one characteristic I really hate thinking about. You have to touch on it on occasion. They have a high aspect ratio to photonic energy. Normally, we're made out of water, you know, hydrogen, oxygen. They're mostly space. There's not a lot of stuff there. You're mostly, as far as a radon gun or an X-ray gun or anything like that, a microwave oven, you're mostly space. It'll go right through you. You're very transparent to stuff. The more heavy metals you have in you, the less transparent you are. So all of a sudden, this very low background radiation, you're very safe. Oh, but I've got enough uranium to start my own reactor in me. Oh, then you're doomed, because even a little bit of background radiation will fry you like a bug. And, of course, uranium hangs out next to, well, the bigger the element, the more complicated the and larger the molecules it likes to have affinity with, which means uranium, plutonium, that kind of thing, hang out next to nuclear material. Cellular nuclear material, sorry, to differentiate.
Right. Yep.
And so when these things,
and that's not the kind of that's not the kind of neighborhood you want them hanging out in.
No, you consider the genetic material, the anvil, and this bloody thing a hammer. Well, every time it gets hit by a photon, because it's not mostly space, it dumps that energy right in the last place you want, right beside your DNA, and it starts acting like a giant chopper circuit, doing all kinds of weird things. You can get weird viruses coming out of the woodwork because these dormant viruses in your DNA all of a sudden pop up and they're again there. But even worse than that, we've been seeing out of the Iraq war, this stuff, uranium specifically, plutonium ends up in your reproductive organ. Don't know why, probably because there's a lot of genetic material down there, but it ends up there. When you do an autopsy, that's where the plutonium...
And it doesn't go away.
You can't chelate this shit out. You know, you could castrate yourself. That's a way of chelating. Not what I recommend, but, you know, it works.
There is some reference to it in the book of Matthew, but I wouldn't follow that.
The uranium ends up in a really weird place. It ends up near your reptile process, right in the core of your brain. And it produces...
In the lizard brain?
yeah, it ends up with all kinds of really funky symptoms, which is what Gulf War Syndrome is. You get that stuff in you, it ends up there, and then it does weird things to your neuron. It actually has a chemical capacity. It screws up neurochemistry. Don't know how, not a lot of studies on it, and I'm not a neurochemist. It affects neurochemistry, where you get things like your digestion stops working, because apparently your digestion is not maintained autonomously by your digestive tract. Your brain actually runs it without letting the rest of you know. Your brain is part of that decision loop, which just doesn't make any sense to me. But I'm not.
Well, there's some more of that intelligent design.
Yeah. You know, if we were worms, yeah, we wouldn't have a problem with this. But we're not worms. We're slightly more complicated. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, they found people getting suddenly fatigued, just passing out like they had sleeping sickness. No sleeping sickness, no little parasite there.
And just
digestion issues.
I know we've been talking about this in terms of Fukushima, but it is worth remembering that coal-fired power plants also release more radioactive material than the average nuclear power plant.
Yep. And the one thing about the coal-fired power plants, everybody thinks, oh, coal is clean. No, coke is clean. Coke is melted down coal. You can actually heat coal up to a point.
In a semi-airless environment, or, yes. Yeah.
Very little air, just enough air to keep the whole thing nice and hot, or oxygen, rather. It keeps it nice and hot, and you burn off all the sulfides and all this other stuff, and the coke processing plants, what they actually use for real, honest-God metallurgy and really fancy stuff, that stuff, they have, you've never seen a more complex site. These things are complicated beyond anything I want. They're more complicated than nuclear power plants. Because they're involving all kinds of weird chemical stage devices.
And yet, just 2 miles from where I live, Chris, there's a little place called Coke Oven Holler. And coke ovens used to look like little beehives carved into the side of a hill, into a hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And minus all of that complicated processing. You know, the idea being to reduce coal down to its constituent, carbon.
It's also how they used to produce, in converted beehive ovens, how they used to produce the carbon monoxide and methane for Victorian houses' gas lights. Now, Victorians didn't really give a damn if you killed yourself with carbon monoxide, but there was a great way. It's called cold gas method. You take a beehive oven, and you just set a little brass rack underneath it, and you spray steam up through it, and it would produce methane and a carbon monoxide and some water, and it would just go on up, and they'd collect that into big tanks, and then they'd pipe that off to people.
But one of the things that I learned over the course of my recent trip is that the coal being dug out of these giant cesspits, and as my new friend Kristen pointed out, these things are not just visible from space; they're visible from the moon. They're so huge in Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
That coal, that Powder River Basin coal, is loaded with uranium. So this 1,000-mile long, these 1,000-mile coal trains that are going to run 40 or so a day, to the Washington coast.
Okay, there's one other issue.
And some of which are already running to BC.
Yep, we've seen them.
Are loaded with that crap.
Yeah, coal deposits that were deposited early in Earth's history are contaminated more with more heavy metals, especially uranium and all that, because they occurred earlier in our geologic history when these things were still dropping out of the mantle. So old places on Earth that have coal, like the eastern seaboard of the United States, some of the oldest rock on the planet, and definitely some of the oldest coal, are the most heavily contaminated with heavy metals. Places like Britain and Nanaimo, right here, we have very young coal fields, or recently risen from the continental shelf and all that, and they go out under the sea, which is sort of an indicator of where they came from. Those are very young, and they are mostly scrubbed of this stuff, so it's actually a safer form of coal. Not to say that they're all safe, it's just...
Yeah, that's kind of like saying it's a safer, you know, that a Marlboro Ultralight is a safer cigarette.
But to tell you the truth, guys, these mining engineers piss me the hell off because they're so goddamn myopic and ignorant. That coal fly ash, that toxic waste that's coming out of a coal fire plant, That is money pouring out. We need those bloody materials. Even the goddamn arsenic has legitimate uses in modern industrial processes. It goes into a shitload of electronics, I hate to say.
But instead, it goes into a little mini mountain or a pond like it did in Kingston, Tennessee, and then winds up breaking and floating down the Clinch and Tennessee rivers.
I've done like 10 cost-benefit analyses on mining other mines, mine tailings. And then when I present them and try to get funding, and another reason I'm not in mining engineering anymore, they tell me, oh, no, 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 we'd rather that dog in the manger. You know, they can't make a buck off it, but they'll be damned if they have you come in and do it and make them look good or bad or stupid or whatever.
Well, but now, lo and behold, there is this mad rush on by Republicans and Coalfield State Democrats to make sure that the EPA doesn't list coal ash as hazardous waste because, and this is what they want to do, they want to use it for supporting a burgeoning drywall, wallboard industry in the U.S.
Fuck. God. You think the shit they're sending out from China is bad? That's apocalyptic, man. I mean, you think the asbestos... Okay, when they did asbestos in Canada and they promoted it, the first place they went to market it was BC, way far away from Asbestos Quebec, where they produce all the asbestos in the world. We didn't know anything about it, so they produced it out here, and they marketed it out here, and almost every goddamn house has asbestos somewhere in its history, whether it was wall tile, wall board, or roof tile, insulation itself, paints. They put it in paints, man. Everything, glues, anything. It's a fiber. It can be used to reinforce any kind of fire or agent or glue or anything just to make it harder, more resilient paint with asbestos. They're doing the same thing with nanotechnology. Oh, now with nanofibers and nanotubes and nano this and nano that. You know what? Nano and all that, great. Leave it in the laboratory, industrial sites. Keep it the hell out of your personal life. If your computer says, now I'm coming with nanotechnology, new nanotubes, throw it the fuck out.
Yep.
It's the modern asbestos. Asbestos. There's all kinds of ways you can get cancer. The oncologist will tell you there's 6 genetic flags for cancer. And if you have 1, I think you're okay. But if you have 2, it becomes cancer to a tumor cell. The other mechanism is uncontrolled scarring, which can happen for things like a cauliflower ear that you might be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Black lung can do this. Again, it's not actually asbestosis. It's sort of a silicosis. It's an uncontrolled scarring in the lungs. Asbestos does it too, but it does it in such a profound way that you can't make it better. It's these microfibers, these nanofibers, the nature's own microfiber piercing the cell, causing it to respond as if it's injured forever, constantly producing these little boils of scar tissue everywhere this thing is. And if it gets moved around, it starts poking into other things. It'll do it there, too. And one fiber can go an awful long way. And that's why they're talking about, you know, zero exposure to asbestos. This stuff is just this toxic as hell. And the nanofibers are there, too. And just, you know, we're inventing a new material. Great. What's in nature that looks like it? Oh, uranium. Well, let's not use that. Oh, good idea. Oh, what's in nature that represents this stuff? Nanofibers. Asbestos. Well, let's not touch that because we'll have the same problems we had with asbestos. But no, somebody can make a buck off of it. It's a new name. It's all marketing. And there are people out there who are willing to make a buck off of literally killing people in Joplin.
And that's what it all comes down to, and that's why I made that the focus of my remarks. You know, that those well-heeled, well-coiffed, well-dressed board members and directors and officers, there's a certain degree of confrontation that they must have, because history judges harshly the people who blithely engage in what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, and that's what the financing of all of this stuff is. Chris, I've got to roll because I've got some other blinking lights, but it's awfully good to hear from you, my friend.
Good luck with the phones.
All right, thanks. Bye. Chris from Nanaimo in British Columbia. It's like a little trip to school every time he calls. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob, how are you doing?
Brother Albert, good to talk to you, brother.
Yeah, oh man, Brother Chris, you're scary. He's a scary scientist.
Scary smart.
Yeah, he's scary. He's got that down too. Well, you know, I do have to say, you know, I just have to bring it up. You know how I love nanotechnology. I love it. This is the next paradigm, you know? But the thing is we're not going into it with a 1850s mindset. You know, I hope not. At first. You know what I mean? And that's really kind of what it is. If we realize that asbestos is dangerous and we realize, you know, like you were talking about, you know, Fukushima and all these other reactors, you know, that's still a Generation 1 reactor. You know, and we do have new ideas for these reactors that, you know, these Gen 4s and these other kind of reactors, you know.
I'd really like to leave the radiation stuff alone and let the wind and sun do what they do so well.
I hear you. However, we already have it. It's already here.
They're online.
These first generation reactors, you know, he was talking about all the daughter products, which are sitting in pools.
Yeah.
They have nowhere to put them, and they have somewhere to go. They want to put them someplace for 50,000 years. Well, these new generation 4 reactors can take those fuel rods, utilize them, and then they have a half-life of 50 years. You see, and so that's what I mean. We have to sit there, and, you know, we can't use the same old thinking, because if we use the same old thinking with, you know, even solar, you know, these are dead-end paradigms, you know what I mean? These coal barren paradigms and these other, you know, natural gas, the first generation nuclear, these things are old paradigms that, you know, they're only led for profit motive and so on and so forth, but now we're sitting here looking at the interconnected nature of, you know, Fukushima is going to affect us. You know, my wife is pregnant. I'm over here going, my God, but I hope I don't come out with a harlequin baby or some kind of crazy depleted uranium thing. I can't even imagine that kind of horror. I can't. I literally cannot. You know, but it's going to happen to people. So what are we going to do? Are we just going to let these things just run amok? Are we just going to leave pools of them sitting around for 50,000 years? I say we use them. I say we utilize cats, like, for example, you're talking about the coal fly ash. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff in there that we can use and utilize. Nanotechnology, we should be utilizing it. But we have to make sure that it's sequestered in a way and handled in a way. We build materials in a way. We got to also stop this, you know, planned obsolescence of materials. We got to stop supporting this kind of business model. You know, if every 5 years, you know, you're sitting here and your thing's outdated, you know, my God, you know, every time you turn around, you got to replace something, or you got to do this and another one. What do you do with it? Where are you going to throw it? In the garbage. And then does it ever get recycled, or does it sit there for, you know, 2 million years? You know, that's you know, we got to start building things to last. We got to start, you know, reassessing which direction we want to go as a species. You know, there's no way we're going to have McDonald's signs floating on space on your way to, you know, City Newton on the friggin' moon. You know, we're not going to have that kind of world. That's not even possible. You don't have to have that kind of stuff if we're not going to utilize the waste resources that we're currently ignorant to their uses and benefits. You know, I say use the stuff where it's already here. It's ready. It's just going to sit around poisoning thousands of years. Let's get it used. Let's make it useful. Let's turn some of those swords into plowshares. You know. That's what these things are. These things are dangerous. It's dangerous to just have Indian Head, you know, Indian River, whatever it's called up there in New York. You know, if those terrorists had any idea to cause damage, they could have sent one of those planes into those pools that they have there at that Indian River. That whole tri-state area that would be uninhabitable for 100,000 years. Everyone in that place would have just, because it would have started a fire in those pits, right? We can't have that. Well, man, use this stuff. Get this stuff out of here. Get it out of here. You know, let's use it. You know, let's get geothermal down. Let's do all that. Absolutely. Let's get solar and wind. Absolutely. But we already have this stuff. We need a base load. You know, I think throwing the baby out with the bathwater is a bit naive. We have uses for these things. You know, and I just think, you know, going in with wide eyes.
If it can be done without killing people.
Well, yeah, true. When you talk about the banality of evil, well, what's the cure to that? We got to speak up and say, hey, asbestos was dangerous. These nanoparticles could be dangerous. So, you know, not to say, you know, heck, who doesn't want to sit here and see battery power? We're not going to get there without nanotechnology. We're just not. We're not going to get there to these carbon, you know, solid-state carbon fiber freaking or carbon nanotube batteries. You know, we're not going to get there without this stuff. You know, so let's contain it. Let's make it safe. You know, we can make batteries. The stuff that's in your Duracell, that's pretty toxic. And as long as you recycle them and send them back, they're all right. They're not going to damage you by handling them. You know what I mean? I mean, because every time you change your battery, and granted, they can leak. And yes, and yes, and yes. So we just need to have an awareness to how products are made and manufactured, to everything, up and down the line. We should have a say in these things. You know, we can't just be, you know, banalities like, well, this is the kind of batteries they got. Oh, well, I don't have a vegetarian option, but I do see those golden arches. You know, that's that banality. You do it to yourself. I do it to my, everybody does it. You know, we're all guilty of this. You know, and so it's up to us to sit here and raise awareness and say, hey, you know, look at this. This is not good. This is that. And let's start addressing them. You know, we need jobs in this country, you know. I mean, Obama's been trying, you know. He's creating jobs. He's creating more jobs than Bush already. But we have so many people. And we have
Look, we were, you know, I was walking around in my highfalutin suit in Charlotte,
mm-hmm.
and the place was crawling with extra highly armed alleged security. We, little 99%ers that we were, we did more job creating than John Boehner's done in 2 years as Speaker of the House. Because there, you know, there were all those jobs of all those gun-toting thugs ready to blow us to kingdom come. We created those jobs out.
Just by
breathing. That job creating business isn't as hard as it looks.
Yeah, Bush was, quite the one, huh? What do we got here? Now, hey, you know, that's a good thing. The president's in the 21st century now.
Yeah,
you know, it almost feels.
Although you'll get a laugh out of this.
Hmm.
Brian Fisher, the guy who ran the policy expert out of the Romney campaign for being gay,
uh-huh.
and then turned around and tweeted, if a hayseed like me can run somebody out of the Romney campaign, how's he ever going to stand up to the Russians? Precious, right? So Brian Fisher tweeted, Shep Smith says Obama now in 21st century. He's right, except it's 21st century B.C., the time of Sodom and Gomorrah.
People.
The mole people and the sleaze stacks, they walk among us.
Yeah, well, you know, and you got Captain Kolob.
Brains.
I mean, Captain Kolob, what is he doing, this guy? What is he doing?
Well, we know what he was doing in his teenage years. He was torturing kids for being perceived gay. Did you run into this one, Albert?
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going for the, you know, but not only that, but Jesus, he's taking credit for everything.
Yeah, well, he single-handedly saved the auto industry in Detroit.
He did that, and I heard that he and God created gay people to test mankind's, you know, level of human acceptance, you know what I mean, and tolerance.
Yeah.
Him and God created those gay people just for that situation.
Well, you know? Probably on one of Kolob's moons.
Yeah, where the special experiments are held.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Where the women folk are kept out of it, you know what I mean? Because women can't be doing all some of that science stuff.
They need to be home making babies.
Yeah, making babies giving them updates.
Piano lessons.
She gives me reports. I get nightly reports from my wife. This guy's such an alien, and then he's beating up gay. What is that? Of course he's a bully. I didn't know.
He chased this kid down and cut his hair in the 1960s. Do you remember, and I hate to drag people back into that filth pit, but do you remember, Brother Albert, when we were dealing with George W. Bush and it came out that he had been involved in incidents when he was a Delta Kappa Epsilon upperclassman at Yale, where he was involved in the process of taking a white-hot heated coat hanger and branding the Greek letter Delta on pledges' bottoms. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. What about the...
That's the same kind of, you know, the blowing up frogs and...
Frogs, yeah.
That's the same kind of sick sociopathy we've got operating in Willard Romney. Here's the way it's reported, and it's been confirmed by no less than, I think, five of his high school classmates. John Lauber, a soft-spoken new student, 1 year behind Romney, was perpetually teased for his nonconformity and presumed, not actual, but presumed homosexuality. Now he was walking around the all-boys school with bleached blonde hair that draped over one eye. And Willard Romney wasn't having it. A few days later, Friedman entered Stevens Hall off the school's collegiate quad to find Romney marching out of his own room ahead of a prep school posse shouting about their plan to cut Lauber's hair. Friedman followed them to a nearby room where they came upon Lauber, tackled him, pinned him to the ground. As Lauber, his eyes filling with tears, screamed for help, Willard Romney repeatedly cut his hair with a pair of scissors.
We're not going to have no long-haired sissy faggots like you here at a good school like ours. Jesus, that's sickening.
Willard, of course, says, let's see. One former classmate and old friend of Romney's who refused to be identified by name said there are a lot of guys who went to Cranbrook who have really negative memories of Romney's behavior in the dorms, behavior his classmate describes as evil and like the Lord of the Flies. Romney says, though, I certainly don't remember it. There were lots of hijinks and pranks. Back in high school, I did some dumb things, and if anybody was hurt by that or offended, obviously I apologize for that. I don't remember that incident, said Romney, laughing. I certainly, don't believe, that I thought the fellow was, homosexual. That was the furthest thing from our minds back in the 1960s, so that was not the case. So isn't it interesting? He doesn't remember it, but he remembers it was not the case that he would have tormented somebody for being perceived gay.
Hey, if I offended anybody, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's not if. It's if they were offended, he's sorry. Yeah, that's the non-apology apology.
Mm-hmm. It's just typical, isn't it? I mean, it is so typical. I think it's only going to get worse for him. As the days go by, the trials of Captain Kolob are going to get tougher and tougher, and you're going to have to dissociate yourself from reality in order to vote for a guy like this.
Or if you insist on voting for that creep, then you're going to have to take him for his all in all, and that includes his willingness to torment a young man who was new to that little insular culture. You're going to have to sign on for that too. And anybody who is familiar with Lord of the Flies knows what an indictment that is of somebody like Willard Romney.
Oh, but it's something that, look at him. I mean, look at what Bain Capital, look at what they do. Look at how he made it.
Right, that was Lord of the Flies writ large in a hyper-capitalist business model, wasn't it?
That was an orgy of cannibalism, if I've ever seen one. And we've seen a few on the horn over the years.
Yes, indeed.
You know, that's where he gets his stuff from. You know, I mean, it's like that, and the dissociation of these people, like, you know, we just had this primary runoff election, and I'm going to be honest, you know, I've been so preoccupied lately, I didn't even hear about it. Okay? I mean, I know that the vote is on June 5th or January or whatever. I know it's over there. You know, that's the main vote. But even though almost no one I even know has heard about it, you know, the primary thing, you know, nobody really paid attention, nobody did anything, Democrats still got more people to vote than the Republicans. But these Republicans act like Walker got more votes than all of them. They can't even see simple numbers. They don't know what almost means. They don't know what less than means. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't even understand these simple little words. They don't know how to read. And they said, they read a headline that'll say, Walker is showing, you know, blah, 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 largest by a governor. And then they'll read into, then he beat. No. And you wait. You wait till you see how many people are going to come out to actually vote. I don't even care. I don't even care, to be honest with you. I was fine with Falk, and I'm fine with Barrett. You know, whatever. I don't care who it is. It's not going to be him. It's going to be someone who's going to try to make this state a little less embarrassing. You know, this state has been hammered with jobs and so on and everything else. You know, this is when whose policies? If Walker wasn't the a little Bush Jr., I don't know who is, right?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's exactly what he did. He comes in, he starts messing with the unions, he starts, you know, giving corporate money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, blaming that on the working people. You know, it's like Wisconsin, we're crazy. Wisconsin ain't about... Wisconsin ain't going to sit back for that. You know, we didn't even know. We don't care. We want to vote the guy out. That's what people care about. Like, primary, shmimary. I don't care. I'm not even doing it. You know, me, I was a little preoccupied. I didn't, you know, I wasn't really paying attention. So that one slipped me out, my bad, but it doesn't matter because we're all going to go out and vote and we're going to crush this guy and send him walking. Tired of this fool. This guy's an embarrassment. You know, and with that, I can't see it. How can it go well for him? You know, he'll sit there and now he's running against Barrett. You know, this guy sitting here, he was, you know, city controller, whatever, you know, Walker, he was in Milwaukee when it was its worst. You know, it's like ever since he's been out of it, Milwaukee's actually been, you know, putting out jobs and getting the, you know, place a little bit, you know, in order. Now he's in government, but the whole state, I think the problem's him. You know what I mean? It's like the old story the captain told me when I was in boot camp. You know, one person calls you a banana, well, you know. But if 20 people call you a banana, or if everywhere you go, everyone's calling you a banana, you're effing banana. And he's a banana, this guy. You know? I mean, there's no doubt about it. Look at him. He's terrible in every way.
Well, like I said, I'm still waiting for some Photoshop genius to get busy morphing Willard's face onto the rat face in the Willard movie poster. And then it'll just be clear.
Mm. Well, I don't know. He just, you know, Willard, Captain Kolob. Forget this guy. This guy, you know, I can't wait to see a nice debate. You know, I think the president's kind of finding some, you know, he found one of his testicles. He did the right thing on, you know, maybe a little too late, but what are you gonna, you know, let's be kind of, you know, let's not get too crazy. You know,
and let's celebrate a moment of an actual stride forward in the social history of this country, so much of whose history has been written in bigotry and discrimination. Let's take a moment and treasure this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give Barack Obama credit for doing the right thing there. And it takes, I'm enough of a realist to understand that it takes a while sometimes
mm-hmm.
for these things, to happen. And as much as the right wing wants to think it's some sort of cynical ploy, I'm more willing to bet that this was a function of conversations across the pillow with Michelle than it was a conversation with his cabinet or his campaign team.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's you know, if you actually think about it, going into an election, it's kind of brave. You know,
let me report back on this real quick, Albert. I did. I spent, let's see, 4 days in Massachusetts. And I found out some interesting things. Massachusetts has an actual growing birth rate. Now, we can have a conversation about whether that's a good or a bad thing relative to the world population, but it has a growing birth rate. It also has a lower divorce rate than, say, family values-oriented Alabama Stan, or Mississippi Stan, or Tennessee Stan, or Georgia Stan. It has a lower rate of teen pregnancy than any of those stands.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not see any... apparently, it's been a couple of years now, right, Albert? And I didn't see any storefront quickie divorce, your heterosexual marriage is over because gay folks can get married courtrooms. I didn't see any of them. I didn't hear one story from one committed heterosexual married person saying, you know, I loved my marriage, but
it's over.
It's over. The day's done. Yeah. Got it. Not one.
All right, well, you know, my wife and I, you know, like, if my wife goes to vote, I don't jump in front of her vehicle to stop her. So we're in agreement with a lot of stuff in this household, and I personally don't understand how a Republican and Democrat could be married, but maybe it's possible. But, you know, for us, it works very well, and, you know, this is just another thing we say, yeah, that makes us feel better. If anything, it brings my wife and I closer together, because now we don't have to feel like, you know, we don't have to have that white guilt. You know what I mean? That, you know, you get, you know, the world and the civilization is benefiting just you because of you being you. You know what I mean? Now it goes to everybody. You know, I don't understand why these people, these conservatards, they sit there and they roll around and they're always talking about the Constitution. What does all mean? Just the three-letter word, all?
It is rather inclusive now, isn't it?
It didn't say some. It said all. Reading comprehension. It's for everyone. It's for everyone. Everyone needs reading comprehension. All. If you know what... But what do you mean you don't know what the word all means? I can't even explain it to you. It should be ubiquitous. Don't you understand it's all? That means all.
Well, and you know, right, and I came away from Massachusetts thinking, you know, it's kind of cold here, but it's pretty nice. And I think it would probably be beneficial for a lot of Alabama Stannies to at least go visit. And a lot of Mississippi Stannies to go visit. And see what a functioning state culture looks like. I mean, I heard all kinds of Boston accents. I heard Spanish accents. I heard accents I couldn't identify. But it was all working. It was all going. It was all doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about the Yankee culture in the Northeast. You know, it kind of leads to, yeah, there's some things they're strict on, but then there's some, like, you know, work ethic and, you know, these kinds of things, and then there are other, and then it doesn't just turn into, you know, anyone, doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter who you are, you know, that's the Yankee kind of mindset, you kind of, just the culture of that, of those states.
Yeah.
It's the only way I can, you know what I'm saying, there's just a certain...
And I loved, I say this as country mouse, and not just country mouse, but southern country mouse, Albert. Mm-hmm. I loved it, I loved hearing the music of the language. I ordered a water with my clam dinner, and I... tap water. And I had to take a minute. You know, my internal translation unit had to pick up and catch on.
Yep.
Yes, please, tap water.
Yeah.
And the lovely conversation I had walking to one of the T stations with one of our guides, when she said, you know, I was down south and I thought they were just all so friendly, and I said, wait, but that was only to your face. That's what the South is really good at. We will be friendly to your face, and the minute you're out of earshot, Marvelline will turn to Dreama and say, did you hear how that Yankee girl talked? And she said, do they really use that word still, Yankee? I said, oh, yes, they do. They're still fighting the war. And they're still upset. They didn't get over it. But, you know, the next time, because one of the big things you hear down here, below the Mason-Dixie line, back here behind the cornbread curtain and below the possum line, one of the things that you hear is, we don't want none of them Massachusetts liberals, actually, we don't want none of them Massachusetts liberals telling us how to live. Well, you know what? I didn't get full immersion or anything, but I had 4 days, and it looks to me that like that Massachusetts liberal society is working pretty damn good. And what's more, having wandered around and talked to some extremely good people, inspiring people, the next time I hear something like Massachusetts liberal, I really want to punch dude in the face and say, you sorry bastard, you're talking about an American citizen. You're talking about one of my co-countrymen. Quit acting like it's a foreign effing country and get your cornbread ass up off of it and out in the street. And demand the same kind of functioning culture that they've got down there, up there, down here. Because you know what? You get a lot more done when you're not sitting around worrying about whether Hans the
Mercedes-Benz executive whom you've just arrested is in the country legally. Just say it.
Yeah.
drives me crazy. But I love these things because I get to think a lot. And I adored it. It worked.
I mean, who's trying to tell you how to live? That's my thing I don't understand. You know, shouldn't the good book, shouldn't all those, and I know they're read as communists, so I'm sure all the red letters in the Bible where it tells you to, you know, respect your brothers and, you know, love them as you love yourself and, you know, really don't concern yourself and how they're living. Like, who's telling you, how is gay marriage going to, negatively impact you? How? How can it? I don't understand. It doesn't affect you. You should feel better because now everybody has the same rights and same freedom.
Everybody's happier. And when everybody's happier, the country works better. Yeah. You know, Jim just dropped me an email, and he said with regard to Romney, Willard, he said, the child is the father of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim said, I know this. And that's worth thinking about. The child is the father of the man. So the nasty little spoiled grandson of a polygamist who tackled and tortured and tormented another young man for not having hair the way he liked it. Well,
hair.
I think we can expect the same kind of conduct out of him that he did there and that he did when he destroyed the lives and well-being of thousands of American citizens while he was at Bain Capital. We can expect the same kind of conduct, Albert, in the White House.
Yes, sir. And that's not change I believe in. You know, that's not any kind of change whatsoever. That's going backwards.
Yeah, that's devolution I despise, not change I believe in.
Yeah.
Albert, I got to roll. There's a couple more blinking, but it's awful good to hear from you, brother. It's awful good to be home and here and have a conversation with you.
Yeah, welcome back, brother.
All right, and I'm headed to Wisco next week.
Oh, really? All right, awesome.
All right.
Right in my business plan. All right, brother.
All right, later. Bye now.
Bye.
And we continue onward. Hey, welcome to the program. Anybody? Welcome to the program.
Hey there.
Hey, Jim, what's up? Oh. I think I must have conjured you.
Perhaps you did. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Trip.
It was an amazing trip, and I think henceforward, as long as I establish a rule that I do not fly from IAD to CRW or vice versa, everything will be just fine.
Well understood. I thought you were traveling with Matt's Airlines. May arrive there sometime.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you start hearing the laboring of those twin engines,
been there.
And I felt like, I think I was thinking of Catch-22 and Yossarian in the nose of that B-25 screaming, climb, you bastard, climb!
Yes, sir. In those cases, I normally used to go to the restroom and just sit there until it all went over, and I thought, well, as long as I'm in the tail of the plane, oh well. Talk about a falseness of security.
Exactly. Right. But, you know, any port in the storm, right?
Exactly. You know, as far as Bank of America is concerned, you know, I've done a lot of business with them. And I remember their founder, Giannini, in San Francisco. And, you know, Bank of America used to represent a lot of positive things for the growth of this country. Unfortunately, that's changed. I don't think Mr. Giannini would be very happy with some of the stuff that's going on now.
No, and they're still getting so much stuff wrong. Now, credit where credit is due, they got some of it right. They came out firmly in opposition to that hateful, bigoted amendment that passed in North Carolina. But that was window dressing. That's easy. You know, the tough stuff is when you make corporate decisions to stop doing things that increase corporate the bank profits at the expense of human life. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're definitely in the business of making money, and, of course, a little window dressing can make, you know, the gay population that has, you know, disposable income coming your way, you know, it's a good strategy on their part.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's one of the big markets they want to capture right now is the gay population, because gay people do have more disposable income than your traditional married folks and who have children to raise, this, that, and the other. So it's a real big area in which concentration has been placed. That's for damn sure.
But what they're doing, and one of the things I met a really dynamic man from Iowa by the name of Mike, and he said, you know, Iowa, the land of 3 million people and 20 million hogs. But it, you know, they have the curse of payday lending upon them out there, Jim, and of course, Bank of America has been instrumental in quietly providing the capital for the payday lending industry, which then charges people in desperate financial straits upwards of 400% interest.
Yeah,
it's a hell of a vig.
Yeah, you know, even, you know, our hated Muslim people, I think what's one of the tenets of the Quran is against usury,
as it is in Judaism.
You know, even Hitler in his 25-point plan originally started out with a doctrine against usury and, you know, excessive interest and things of that nature. That's one of the things he got started on and started attracting people with. It was one of the original Nazi plans. Now, he forgot it, but he sure as hell used it.
Rather quickly, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, these payday lending scams are a blight in any community. You know, they don't put payday lending offices up in McMansion settlements.
I'm sure they don't. But you have Montel Williams and all these people getting up there telling you to send them an email or give them a call. And even they have the American Indians in on it, too, saying what, sky lending or something like that, saying, you know, anything's better than a bounce check, and they try to make it so attractive to people who are very desperate in their efforts to make ends meet.
Yeah, there's an entire subsegment of the American economy that is predicated on nothing but the financial fears of people who are struggling from day to day, whether it's payday lending or rent-to-own cheap furniture outlets.
Absolutely, Bob.
You know, you can go into RTO or whatever it is, and see a really low-end computer that you might pay $450 for, but by the time you get done paying rent to own for it on a weekly basis, the damn thing's as expensive as the Uniblab 10,000.
Absolutely. You know, my dad back in the 50s and 60s used to rant on this constantly, and he said, "You people are worried about the mob coming to South Carolina?" He said, "Look on every corner at every finance company." He said, "Who do you think funds them?"
Yeah, even the mob doesn't have the gall. There's that word again. Doesn't have the gall to charge 400% interest, but Bank of America is more than happy to finance an organization that does.
My God, that's vigorous that Albert Anastasia and the commission would have been proud to, don't you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you think about the Godfather, you know, Hyman Roth sitting on his veranda in Cuba would blush at such an idea.
Oh, absolutely. And we're bigger than U.S. Steel.
There you go.
Tell you, it's just incredible.
Well, it is kind of nice to see the positive response, you know, you've been up east, and I've just had a nice little adventure up there. Fritz just wrote from Arkansas. He said, "In July 2009, I flew from Arkansas to New Hampshire to visit a friend. Although I am an Arkansas born and bred, I did not want to leave. She lived in the southeast part of the state near the Massachusetts and Maine borders. We visited those states and even drove briefly into Vermont. I'd love to get back up there again."
Well, Bob, these people are extremely honest with you. And do not talk about you behind their back. I mean, what you see is what you get. But in the South, talking about one behind one's back or just being two-faced, it's an art form.
It's an art form, and it's a cultivated way of life, isn't it, Jim?
I used to tell people like that, and I knew what they were saying to me, and I said, you know, there's only two things I don't like about you. Your face.
Well said. Well said.